being that 9 o'clock has arrived, we will begin the regular meeting of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District for March 17th, 2021. I understand that we have Director Armstrong on the phone, and Director Record is here, but in a meeting and will be joining us a little later. And I understand Director Slauson will also be joining us a little later this morning. With that, before we do the pledge, may I get the secretary to call the roll and make sure that our legal counsel is on the line.
Sure. Legal counsel, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Good morning, everyone.
Thank you. Dr. Corona?
Here.
And Dr. Polly?
I'm here.
Okay, and Dr. Armstrong?
I am here.
Thank you.
Very good. With that, we do have a quorum, so we can open our meeting. And if we would, we will do the Pledge of Allegiance. If I could ask, I see we have a distinguished visitor in our audience this morning. If I could ask former Director Sullivan if he would mind leading us the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Ron. April, do we have any other guests this morning, or do we have anybody who has requested the opportunity to do public comment this morning?
We have not received any requests, and we do have several guests on the phone.
Okay, very, very good. With that, we will go to item two, which is this morning's presentation, which are 2021 state issues updates, and I understand, Danielle, you are going to present that to us, correct? Good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly and members of the board. It's good to see you all this morning. It's my distinct pleasure to, pardon me, let me take this off. It is my pleasure to introduce to you today our state advocates. Annually, as you know, we have our state and federal lobbyists join us for a board meeting to share the latest and also to hear sort of the boots-on-the-ground perspective. I know you've already heard from our federal advocates. So today, I am very pleased to introduce and reintroduce to you our state advocates with Namela Pappas and Associates. We have on the line today Aaron Namela and Jamie Miner, who will be sharing today's state update. Jamie, Aaron. And I'll be running through their slides that they have prepared for us today.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Aaron and Jamie?
Could we see if we could?
Yes.
Okay. We will take a minute to find our state lobbyist.
My apologies, there was a brief miscommunication. They will be on the line very shortly.
We will wait for them. I'm anxious to hear what they have to say, so.
Thank you. Aaron and Jamie, have you had an opportunity to join us yet?
Would you like to circle back with them and we could take another presentation while we're waiting, or do you think they'll join us?
If we want to give them 30 seconds longer and then...
We could do that. If not, we will... We could go on to... We're going to do, just so everybody knows, we're doing a little audible on the agenda this morning. We're going to do our residential customer satisfaction survey next, but if you could find them... We'll give them a few more minutes.
I appreciate it. Thank you. I apologize.
No problem.
I'm frankly enjoying the meditative silence, too. Sorry. Couldn't resist.
It is a nice reprieve from the usual events, except for the person at the podium.
Except for the person.
They are receiving a busy number, a busy tone.
Tell you what, why don't we go ahead and straighten that out?
Sounds
we
good.
We will move
Thank
on
you.
To Roxanne. Yes, are you ready for your presentation? So
our
we
apologies,
are...
President Pauly, members of the board. We'll straighten this up.
All right, not a problem. We were going to go on in deference to our two directors who will be joining us in a minute. I don't want to do any voting before they're able to join us. But I would like to hear from Ms. Roundtree on our 2021 Residential Customer Satisfaction Survey. So good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly, board, and staff. The item I have before you this morning are the results of our 2021 Customer Satisfaction Survey. As you know, we routinely conduct satisfaction surveys to better understand our customers' perceptions and needs. These surveys allow our organization to not only gain insights into our customer opinions of us, but even more important, it allows PGA to develop messaging and help steer programs and services that will allow our customers to become even more satisfied with EMWD. Our last survey was conducted in 2018. At that time, the survey was conducted solely by phone. So this year, to address the changing demographics and preferences of our customers, we've changed modalities, and the survey was conducted both online and via phone. So in December, we solicited and received 7 bids to conduct this latest survey, and after a rigorous review process, EMC Research was selected as the most qualified firm. I think you'll be pleased with the results that you hear today, and I'd like to introduce Tom Patras with EMC Research, who will provide an overview of the methodology and the findings from our 2021 Customer Satisfaction Survey. Tom, are you on the phone?
I am.
Very good. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Roxanne. Thank you all. As Roxanne mentioned, my name is Tom Patras. I'm a principal and COO with EMC Research. And I'm going to run through the results of our customer survey here for you this morning. I understand you've got a busy day and a full agenda, so I'll try to go through this quickly, but happy to answer any questions that may arise. So we go to the next slide. As Roxanne mentioned, this was a multimodal survey. So we had a telephone component. We invited folks to complete it online, both through email and texting. We completed a total of 500 interviews back at the end of January. And where we can, we'll compare the results to 2018 and 2014 studies that, as Roxanne mentioned, were conducted by phone. On the next slide, some overall key findings. As Roxanne also mentioned, very good news generally overall here. Folks have very positive opinions of EMWD, giving you all high marks, both on overall job performance and on overall favorability rating, overall job performance, as well as on specific job attribute or service categories that we tested. Favorability and satisfaction ratings have all improved since the previous study in 2018. We did test some public information or messaging in this survey to, you know, better understand whether and how we can best tell the story of EMWD and all the great work that you're doing. And what we found is, you know, there's a few different ways that you could tell, and each of them were sort of equally compelling, particularly focusing on, you know, the support for the community, helping customers, and helping them save money and save water, and then also the actions that you all are taking to effectively manage the water supply, both today as well as, you know, planning for the future. And then we did a quadrant analysis, which I will get to more in a bit, but, you know, looking for areas where you might be able to strengthen ratings or strengthen opinions even more beyond where they are today, we did identify a couple opportunities where it comes to tap water. So moving ahead, the next slide. Overall EMWD favorable rating. We can go one more slide. There we go. This is on a favorability scale, so from strongly favorable to strongly unfavorable. What's your opinion of EMWD? And you can see 76% favorable overall, 35% of that is strongly favorable against only 13% on the unfavorable side. These are extraordinarily high ratings. We went and looked at, you know, comparisons to other water agencies in California that we do work for, and this was the highest that we've seen among the different water agencies. So, some, you know, very, very strong rating, and, you know, y'all should be proud of that and the work that you all are doing. On the next slide, you can see how that breaks down among some of the key demographics, and pretty consistent across the board, a bit higher intensity in certain areas, particularly with folks in Division 4 and Latinx voters. But you can see, you know, a lot of blue on this chart and not a whole lot of red, suggesting that, you know, kind of across the board, the district is held in high regard. On the next slide, you can see how this compares to the 2018 study. So one thing to note here, with the change in mode, we do have some mode effects going on. You can see there was a much higher percentage of don't know, never heard. You know, we have a much higher percentage of folks who are familiar with the water district when we added that web component, you know, for various reasons, if you think about how the two methodologies work. But the good news is that, you know, that all went to the favorable side. No change in the unfavorable, which remains very low at 13%. You know, and again, the overall favorability at 76%, suggesting, you know, there's a good deal of growth in favorable opinions of the district since 2018. On the next slide, overall job rating on a 1 to 7 satisfied scale. How satisfied are you with the job the district is doing overall? 38% gave that the highest rating, a 7 on a 1 to 7 scale, another 46% at least somewhat satisfied. 83% overall satisfaction. Again, you know, that's the highest we have seen in recent years among any of our other water district clients in the state. Now, on the next slide, again, some key demographics here. Similar story, a whole lot of blue, not much red, you know, pretty universal satisfaction across the district geographically and demographically. On the next slide, this was a question that you all have been asking in the last couple iterations of this study, whether folks can correctly name their water district. And you can see we've seen, you know, a good increase in that as well. You know, there's likely a mode effect happening here to some extent as well when we added the web component. But you can see that familiarity with the district and ability to name the district and an open-ended question, can you tell me who your water provider is much higher here in 2021 than it was in the previous two studies. the next slide on service importance. So we did both a testing of, you know, how important are each of these services to you, as well as see in a second how satisfied you are with each of these. And you can see here, again, this is a 1 to 7 scale, the sevens being very important, and very high ratings on the seven. So people choosing the, you know, most intense point on that scale of the very important. And And reliability and safety of tap water, you know, very high on that list, obviously a high priority for folks, and quality of tap water as well. Those three kind of, you know, in a top tier there. The next group, you know, customer service, cost of service, and then effectively managing current and then planning for future water needs. That's sort of that next tier, also very important to folks. And you can see on down the list, all of these rated as at least somewhat important, but the intensity starts to fall off a bit. That's not to suggest you don't focus on those things or those things are not important, but when they're stacked up against all of the other things, particularly reliability and safety, they trail in intensity of importance ratings from your customers. On the next slide, you can see sort of satisfaction ratings. And, you know, again, the good news, a lot of blue on this slide, a lot of sevens, which, you know, it's rare to get a lot of seven ratings on a satisfaction scale for anyone doing anything. And for you to have, you know, several of them that are over a majority, many that are over a third, again, speaks to the high regard with which most customers view EMWD. And you can see similar items at the top, which is good when they're at the top of both of these scales, reliability of water. In particular, safety is up there as well. And then we'll go to the next slide, because I want to kind of show you, you know, what we do with this data. So we put it into this quadrant analysis, and, you know, in an ideal world, you're sort of at or near that dotted line, which means that you're meeting expectations with your performance. So the vertical axis is important. If you're, you know, high on the vertical, then that's an element that customers rated as being very important. And then the horizontal axis is satisfaction. So if you're all the way over to the right, that's an area where customers have rated satisfaction high. So the upper right quadrant are things that are both important and you're doing well in terms of customer ratings. The lower left is where you're meeting expectations. So, you know, satisfaction might be a little bit lower, but it's also a less important element. And then the upper left is, you know, where we consider our sort of opportunities for improvement, because those are areas that are, you know, rated as important, but the satisfaction is a little bit lower. And if we go to the next slide, you can kind of see where everything falls out. And a lot of these up in the upper right quadrant and down in the lower left. So, you know, meeting or exceeding expectations on both the things that are of highest importance and some things that are a bit less important. So that's great to see. As I mentioned at the beginning, you know, a couple of the things that are in that opportunity to improve area have to do with tap water, both in terms of quality of tap water and taste of tap water. You know, so as we look at, you know, results like this that are so really overwhelmingly positive, we also want to try to look, well, how could we make our ratings even better? How could we improve the situation? And in terms of tap water, there could be an opportunity there to, you know, talk about all of the great work that you all are doing in that area. And just a note on cost of service, that's almost always going to be up in this quadrant. No one is ever particularly happy that they have to pay for anything. But, you know, we do find generally when we talk to, you know, water service customers that, you know, the cost of service isn't as high of a concern for them relative to other utilities and services that they pay for. But they're almost never going to say they're satisfied up to and until we all give it away for free. So just a couple more slides on the next slide here, or two slides, I guess. We talk about messaging. And as I mentioned at the beginning, this was our attempt to try to figure out how we can best tell the story of EMWD. And you can see pretty consistent, you know, nearly identical results for the top four messages that we tested that talk about the community programs, you know, helping customers save money and water, you know, smart investments in infrastructure, and then, you know, using cost-effective recycled water. Again, those kind of fit in with those higher priorities of planning for future water supplies and managing the current water supply. So, you know, not one of these, sort of the downside here is not one of these jumped out as completely obvious as you should definitely be talking about this. The plus side of that is, you know, there's a number of different ways for us to tell the story of EMWD that, that folks will respond to positively. On the next slide, you can see sort of the overall impact of that messaging. So they were re-asked that favorability rating question, and we saw a nice bump all the way up to 89% favorable after folks heard just those five, you know, relatively brief messages about some of the work that you all are doing. Our last section here, the next slide, so contacting EMWD. You know, in the last 2 years, have you contacted the district for any reason other than, you know, paying your bill? A little over a third, 38%, said yes, they had. If they were in that group, they were asked a follow-up question. You know, how would you rate that experience? 66% positive against only 32% negative, which, you know, is really an extremely positive rating that you're getting two-thirds of folks who are calling likely with an issue, likely with, you know, some sort of negative experience. And even in that context, they come away two-thirds of them feeling like it was a positive experience. And only 11% said poor, with well over a third saying excellent. On the next slide, visiting EMWD.org, you know, have you visited it? Do you find it useful? And among that group, you know, among customers overall, 56% say they visited and found it useful. And those, along with folks who said it was not useful, were asked the follow-up question, you know, why are they visiting it? And, you know, you can see the vast majority there have to do with the bill. So 60% of that group said pay my bill or check my bill amount. So you can see that that's a primary function or reason why folks are coming to the website. On the next slide, specifically with the My Account portal usage, you know, do you use that, yes or no? And those who said no, that 39% group, were asked a sort of why not type of question. And, you know, what we're really looking for here is if there's something in the design of the site or the functioning of the site or something that is really troubling folks as a reason they don't want to use it. And we don't really see that here. What we see are a lot of, I just pay my bill in other ways, type of responses. So, or I just don't want to. I use online banking. I use other payment methods. I prefer a paper bill, those types of things. So nothing here that we saw that, really raised any red flags with the My Account portal. And our last slide here, drinking water type. This is a question that, you know, you all have been asking the last couple versions of the survey as well. We continue to ask this to try to get a sense of, you know, what type of water folks are drinking. You know, and this kind of ties into what I had mentioned previously about opportunities to improve and strengthen ratings. But you can see, you know, 12% say they drink it straight from the tap. That other group of folks there were asked a follow-up question for why they don't drink tap water. And 34% of that group, you know, a third said it does not taste good or smell good. Another 17% say they don't trust it, not safe, poor quality. You know, so those two together, 51% of that group that don't drink tap water right now, either, you know, real or perceived concerns about its taste and quality, which, you know, I think is again, a potential opportunity for you all to continue to communicate with folks about, you know, the reality of the safety of the water and, you know, potentially could even make some gains there or potentially strengthen opinions and ratings overall. So that's all I have today. Like I said, I know I was going kind of fast and talking kind of fast, but happy to answer any questions if there are, or Roxanne, I don't know if there's anything else you wanted me to touch on.
No, thank you. That was a very good presentation. This is Phil Pauly, the president of the board. I just had one question. In your survey research, is there anything that stood out to you that was unusual or something we at the district could improve?
I wouldn't say, you know, anything was necessarily surprising. I think that, you know, one thing that stood out was sort of the overall ratings and, you know, something, you know, you all are, you know, should be bragging about when you're getting together with folks from Metropolitan or, you know, up north in East Bay Mud and Santa Clara Valley Water, who are a couple other clients of ours, you know, who we tell them, they get pretty good ratings too, but they're not this high. So don't tell them that you guys are doing better. But I think that was one thing that stood out you know, we looked at. And then, you know, looking at the demographics and, you know, trying to dig into the data, because whenever we see something like that, we don't want to just say, oh, everything's great, keep doing what you're doing. We want to try to give you something more to go on. But, you know, honestly, there wasn't a ton there because, you know, opinions are so generally positive across the board.
Very good. Do any other directors have any other comments or questions on this? Roxanne, any final closing thoughts?
No, thank you. Well, President Pauly, this is Director Armstrong.
Director Armstrong, sir.
Yes. So I have a couple comments and a couple questions. So just on the comments, I concur. These are really excellent results, and it really shows the accomplishments and commitment that every employee at Eastern has to contribute to the mission of the district to see these kinds of results. So I just want to extend my compliments to every employee at Eastern Municipal Water District to see this. And I like the fact that these results are being tracked over time so you can see the trends, and you're using those trends and outcomes to drive improvements on the perception and the communication of Eastern. So I thought that was really good. Just a question for Tom. The sample size of 500, we have 150,000 accounts, so, you know, something like 750,000 people. Could you just talk to, you know, how confident that these results represent, you know, the real sentiment of most of our customers? And also, you showed divisional breakdowns, and I just wondered how the sample was spread across the different divisions.
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. You know, we received the customer list from EMWD, and our sample was built through that. So we took a random sampling of the customer list and then, you know, made sure that as the data was coming in and we were doing our analysis, that the data collection was matching the, you know, demographic and geographic breakdowns of the customer data. So, you know, a sample size of 500 gives us an overall margin of error plus or minus 4.4. And, you know, that assumes it's a random sampling, which this was. And, you know, as sort of how statistics work, if you're taking a truly random sample of a population, you know, you can project that out to that entire population within a, you know, confidence interval on a certain margin of error. And when we do 500, you know, like I mentioned, that gives us a 4.4 overall margin of error. Now, when we're looking at the demographics, both the division or, you know, age, gender, ethnicity, et cetera, you know, those margins get larger as those sample sizes of the subpopulations get smaller. But they're still, you know, representative of the broader population within those stated margins. So I would say that, you know, this was designed and is representative of your entire district population.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Very good. If we have no more questions, we want to thank you for that presentation and appreciate it. Thank you, Roxanne.
Great. Thank you all.
I will make a note that Director Record now has joined us at the dais. Good morning. I understand now our state representatives, we have them on the line, ready to go. So, Danielle, the floor is yours.
Thank you, and my apologies. We did have a technology
glitch. Not a problem.
It's
called COVID.
Yeah. Okay, so, again, it is my pleasure to introduce Aaron Nimala and Jamie Miner, our representatives from Nimala Pappas & Associates. Aaron and Jamie.
Thank you, Danielle, and thank you for the honor for being here today. I'm sorry we had a few technical problems, and we look forward to actually seeing you in person sometime in the near future. Just a quick introduction on Jamie and I. Our firm is a full-service lobbying firm that employs five lobbyists. We work, obviously, both sides of the aisle in Sacramento and have a strong history working for the leadership of the state legislature, several of the leaders in the House, which we call the Assembly, of course, and the Senate. And me in particular also has a significant amount of experience working for leadership on the federal level as well. So thank you again for the opportunity to talk to you today. We wanted to start, our first slide is on a lot of things you know on the COVID-19 impacts of the 2021 legislative session. Many of you probably have Sacramento contacts and have read in the paper, but we thought we would just kind of fill you in on some of the details about how that's playing out in the legislative session. What we've seen is a lower introduction of bills, but still a very high introduction of bills. So about 2,500 different pieces of legislation were introduced at the outset of the session, many in the resources area, a significant number affecting water. We have also seen a quick pivot to legislative hearings and bill referrals. Bills are moving much quicker than they have in the past, and have, as many of you have read about and which we've been tracking, there have been some very early budget actions in an effort to deal on the front end of the budget with some of the crisis issues, including issues that have been identified as crisis issues addressing the state workforce and employer responsibilities. The legislative calendar is otherwise essentially back to normal. We saw that hearings were, up in the air a lot last year. The calendar continued to change through the process. We are beginning to notice a stabilization of that, even as the legislature has waived rules to take up things they've determined to be priorities very early in the process. Remote voting is still not a reality in the legislature. Many legislators are working from their homes, whether those are the homes in their district or whether those are their homes in Sacramento, and they are monitoring and participating in behind-the-scenes meetings via, remote participation. But the actual voting has to occur in person based on a determination made, an interpretation of the Constitution. Legislative priorities, obviously, always watching for the types of things that affect Eastern. Pandemic response, not at all surprising, and that has really taken a tone of immunization and getting those immunizations done in an orderly and quick fashion with an emphasis on equity issues. And that equity theme is one that has permeated every discussion in the Capitol, and it is defined in different ways. There is an emphasis on homelessness. There's an emphasis on providing housing generally to folks who are having difficulty retaining their housing, housing support for folks to pay rent, and then waivers or requirements of landlords to waive rents. And we're beginning to see that discussion heat up again as it relates to even commercial properties. There is a continued focus on wildfire response, which has spilled over into a focus on infrastructure issues generally. And there, along the lines of the equity theme, there has also been a focus on police reform. And then just generally, I think we are seeing a ton of one-time revenue that the state is grappling with how to spend. So the state has a long history, as many of you know, with, a volatile revenue structure that is supported by the state tax and capital gains at the same level as personal income. We're one of the few states to do that, and we have a very what is often called progressive income tax structure, which, results in a tremendous amount of volatility. And so revenues are high but they are high coming from certain types of taxpayers, and they can fall just as dramatically. And we have significant constitutional constraints and requirements in terms of how that revenue is spent. We also have a tremendous amount of debt in the state, in the form of pension debt, and actually a not insignificant amount of bonded indebtedness. And so those obligations combined with our constitutional school obligation, which is a minimum of 40% of every dollar that comes into the state in the form of revenue, have resulted in the beginnings of quite a dance between legislative leadership and the governor's office in terms of how to spend one-time funds so they don't result in ongoing liabilities. And then finally, I think we are all spectators in this effort, but there is a significant effort to recall the governor. The time for which that effort has to come to culmination is April 29. I think we can actually go on to the next slide. The initial read is that the raw signatures are sufficient, and if they are certified by April 29th, and this does qualify, we are expecting a late summer election. Just in terms of the mechanics of that, a recall election is a, for lack of a better phrase, a sudden death scenario. The recall happens, as you may all remember from the Gray Davis recall, at the same time as the replacement. The governor, the current governor, is prohibited from being his own replacement. And so the voters will cast two votes at the same time. And it is anticipated that it will be, of course, a special election. And there are already a number of candidates who have declared for that. So it is definitely one to watch. In terms of appointments for the U.S. Senate, the governor recently, of course, appointed longtime state senator and former L.A. City Council member before he was the state Secretary of State, Alex Padilla. He is very well respected in the state, longtime staff person to Dianne Feinstein at sort of the district office level. And he's definitely off to the races. There has been significant discussion, including a tremendous amount of press even yesterday, and speculation about whether or not this governor will have an opportunity to appoint for another U.S. Senate seat. But that's something everybody is waiting to hear about. In the meantime, the governor does have an open AG post, state AG post, to which to appoint. The most recent prior attorney general, who is in transition, it would appear, he is vying for a position in the Biden administration, which is everyone expects to be confirmed. And so we expect a new attorney general appointment very soon. The front runners for that appointment are Sacramento mayor and former pro tem of the Senate, Daryl Steinberg, and alongside him, a longtime legislator, assembly member from the Bay Area, from an Alameda-based district, Rob Bonta. Both of those gentlemen, of course, are lawyers, and both have significant national ties. The Secretary of State was recently appointed. She is a very well-respected leader from the State Assembly, Dr. Shirley Weber, and has just begun the job. So we'll wait to see how that interfaces with the recall efforts. New assembly, our new policy chairs that are relevant for our purposes, Assemblymember Lise Rivas who's a Democrat from L.A., is the new chair of the Assembly Natural Resources Committee. She's a very approachable chairperson, but obviously, as you would expect for that committee title, she's very much aligned, with the interests of some of the environmental groups, which one would expect with her district. Senator Tom Umberg is the new chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. In the past, and traditionally, this is a chairpersonship that has gone to a member who is closely aligned with consumer groups and advocacy groups on sort of the progressive end of the equation. This is a senator who's more moderate in his ideology and temperament. He's from Anaheim, which is a more politically balanced area of the state than previous chairs. And so we are all waiting to see how that ends up affecting policy considerations there. And then State Senator Nancy Skinner, a longtime budget chair in the lower house, who hails from Berkeley, is the chair of the Senate Budget Committee, replacing Holly Mitchell, who went to the LA Board of Supervisors. So in the next slide, talk a little bit about the legislative makeup, which did not change significantly in the last election cycle, though there were some Democratic gains in the Senate. It's safe to say that Democrats have a 3/4 majority in both houses. How those caucuses are comprised is actually pretty varied within the Democratic spectrum. The Senate now has 30 Democrats and 9 Republicans and a vacancy. The Assembly, 60 Democrats, 19 Republicans, and an independent. In the old days, pretty much as far back as I can remember, which is to Pete Wilson, Democrats and Republicans had to work together to get major things passed. Bond issues, was virtually impossible to override a governor's veto. And they had to work together to get the budget done and any appropriation. We now have a majority vote budget, but Democrats have more than a supermajority. And so it's really changed the dynamic in terms of how things are done in the Capitol, in which Democrats are negotiating with Democrats of different ideologies or varied ideologies, and there is much less coordination with the Republicans. I think, in the old days we called it the Big Five, the two Republican leaders, the two Democratic leaders, who were usually the leaders of the houses, and the governor. And now, really, that has been taken over by the Big Three. Most of the issues that we will be watching that are infrastructure issues, and certainly all of the issues that we are watching that are in the budget, will really be decided by the two legislative leaders and the governor's office. And then I think just the next slide, I'm going to turn it over to Jamie right after this. On the governor's proposed budget, it's a $227 billion budget. The important thing to note with California's budget, yes, it is the largest budget of all the states. Yes, California continues to be the fifth largest economy in the world. But our budget actually has a significant amount of special fund and federal money that is unlockable by the legislature. A good portion of that is the federal component of what we call Medi-Cal, the Medicaid program. So the discretionary budget, if you can call it that, is about $160 billion. And within that, again, education is locked up at 40% or more of that, depending on the special combination of factors you look at to determine the minimum obligation from year to year, which is influenced by revenue and the consumer price index and some other things. So something to keep in mind in terms of budget discretion. Priorities, of course, and continue to include education, and, of course, there's federal money for that. The state actually got quite a windfall in federal funds, but there was also a significant amount of budget funding, which the governor and the legislature agreed to provide to schools sort of in exchange for reopening. And this is heavily focused on keeping classrooms safe, both for, the unionized employees, the teachers, and other classified employees, and for the students. There is significant ongoing funding for wildfire prevention. Is a robust discussion about business tax credits, including tax credits proposed by the governor intended for smaller businesses. There are also conversations behind scenes about one-time credits for some of the larger but impacted businesses in the state. And there is a very robust discussion about electric vehicle charging and infrastructure, as the governor has made one of his priorities, the sort of phasing out of gas vehicles in the state. And I'm going to turn it over to Jamie now.
Thanks, Erin. Thought we'd jump into, you know, what was included in the budget that, you know, could be a most impact to the district and of interest. Right out of the gate, we saw the legislature get busy with the governor on some early action budget items. You know, it wasn't necessarily following the ordinary timeline we see for budget negotiations, just because the gravity of the issues at hand. Specifically, the moratorium on rental evictions was expiring, and the legislature needed to approve that via a bill. So right out of the gate, we saw a pretty large relief bill to address the issue of rental evictions and specifically payments. The good news is that, you know, while the legislature passed its $2.6 billion relief package, that language also allowed for the funding of unpaid utility bills, which was pretty broad in what that utility bill could be. Eastern's team has been working closely with our association to urge the legislature to allocate additional funding and dedicated funding in the amount of at least $1 billion for past due public water, wastewater agency bills. The thought is that the state has the opportunity right now to appropriate significant one-time funds during this budget cycle, given the windfall that Erin just mentioned. What ended up happening with this funding that passed was it's allocated to the HCD, which is the Housing and Community Development Agency, and renters can apply, via their county to get some of that relief. So I know our team is working directly with our county to figure out, how we can get some of that directed to ratepayers. Additionally, hot off the press with the passage of the American Rescue Plan, there is additional good news. Cities with municipal utility departments, the water, wastewater, power, can likely use their direct allocation to address utility debts that resulted from COVID, and also provide funding directly to utility customers to pay back unpaid bills. So similarly, the state likely can use a portion of its $26 billion, which, is a lot of money, to stand up a program to help address that. So, our trade associations are really close on this issue, really focusing on it, whether that results in a legislative vehicle, establishing some sort of mechanism. We need to get this funding out to ratepayers, and that's the goal and the message that they're touting in the legislature. And then next slide. So as far as, what was included in this round of the governor's January proposed budget, there is some significant funding for infrastructure and specifically water. We saw a prioritization of funding for SGMA projects, so SGMA relief for groundwater sustainability plans and agencies. And then, of course, the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Program. We were happy to see upheld, the continuous appropriation for $130 million. That was obviously part of the deal that was an SB 200 a few years ago that comes from the cap and trade expenditure plan. We also, saw a dedicated portion of funding go to the restoration of natural areas and ecosystems, which was about $250 million in total. Won't go through all of these, but one we wanted to highlight was the $125 million to support multi-benefit water quality projects. So, these would the project for habitat restoration, ecosystem restoration, via the voluntary agreements that, you know, are currently being negotiated. And the thought is, you know, that funding could go towards these projects that were ultimately, you know, negotiated in those agreements. There was funding for flood management, about $183 million, as well as restoration for projects along the San Joaquin River and the Delta area. Next slide. So as for legislation this year, as Aaron said, you know, a ton of bills right out of the gate. You know, it was clear that members are focused on issues other than COVID this year and want to get back to work. So, you know, it's always nice to be on the offensive and push and support meaningful and helpful legislation. So that's what you see here. We're making up for lost time after, you know, we had last year. A number of these measures failed just due to the situation, the truncated calendar and the focus on COVID. The first bill, SB 230, by Senator Portantino. He's a great author. He's the chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. This bill would require the State Water Resources Control Board to establish and direct ongoing constituents of emerging concern programs, which would assess the state of information and recommend areas for further study of the occurrence of CECs in drinking water. This bill, it passed out of the Senate Environmental Quality Committee this week with an amendment to strike PFAS from the program, since there already is a separate program at the Water Board to address that issue. There are some concerns that we heard from the environmental community. They would like to see a program that, you know, if we have such a program at the Water Board, they want it to also include environmental considerations. So not a huge surprise, but conversations are ongoing. And this bill is sponsored by MET as well as CMUA, our trade association. And then SB 351 by our water champion, Senator Caballero. You'll see her name quite a bit, just since, you know, she loves to work in this space. This bill is also sponsored by our trade association, CMUA. It would create the Office of Water Innovation at the California Water Commission. So this office, its intent would be to increase collaboration among state agencies on innovative approaches, engage stakeholders, review regulations that may limit innovation or the adoption of new technologies, and then it would make recommendations for how to streamline some of those regulations. So obviously, you know, with this bill, we think the biggest hurdle will be the fiscal tag. You know, creating a new agency or a new department at this time obviously will come with needed employees and funding. So, you know, while we do have a surplus this year, you know, years out, you know, we're expecting that to diminish. So we expect that to be the biggest hurdle down the road. And then AB 818, this is actually a bill that might be familiar by Assemblymember Bloom from Santa Monica. It's the third year it's been introduced. It would require non-woven disposable products, so wipes, to be clearly and conspicuously labeled to communicate that they should not be flushed. Obviously, that can wreak havoc on wastewater systems.
Well, I was finally going to say, the good news is it's been negotiated with the bankruptcy.
If you are not speaking or providing a presentation, can you please mute your phone?
So this bill was negotiated with the consumer product industry, who in the past had opposed it. So that's good news as far as what it means for its passage. You know, while, again, failed last year due to just the COVID nature of things, we expected to have a much smoother road to passage this year now that the opposition is on board. And then SB 323, also by Senator Caballero. This bill is sponsored by AQUA and was a result of many conversations over the interim on the issue of fee disputes around Proposition 218. So this bill would authorize a local agency or person to bring a validation action in a court to determine the validity of a fee or charge. It establishes the statute of limitations for the time period for which they could propose some sort of action to a superior court. So we expected trial attorneys to oppose this bill, but it's an important bill just because we saw so many lawsuits on Prop 218 last year and popping up after many years of not hearing anything. So that is also by Senator Caballero. And then lastly is SB 442 by our representative, Chad Mays, on the Surface Mining and Reclamation Act. So this bill, it amends the Surface Mining and Reclamation Act and would allow MET to prepare a single reclamation plan for earth-moving operations in its service territory. The intent of this bill really is just for regulatory consistency and efficiency, across their service territory, which spans, as you know, multiple counties where they own and operate infrastructure. This bill was also introduced last year, but was shelved due to pandemic, so we're happy to see it back again this year. And then as far as the funds, we've heard talk for a few years about, the need for bonds, especially given the focus on wildfire prevention and the legislature. But this year, we're seeing a focus due to the economic recovery aspect and the need to focus on infrastructure and resilience. And we've seen pretty aggressive, $5.5 billion bonds introduced and $6.7 billion in the case of AB 1500. We're working closely with our delegation. We made a lot of traction last year on some of the items that are priorities for the water district, including septic to sewer conversions, as well as additional funding for water recycling and other, water infrastructure projects, especially, as we are on the heels of potentially another drought. We're hoping that we get traction to increase the funding for those specific items. There was funding included in the original versions of both for water infrastructure, but we're hoping to get those numbers up and make it a more significant portion of the bond moving forward. Yesterday, actually, was our first committee hearing on SB 45, and really, the bulk of the discussion was just from stakeholders that are in support but are asking for more funding for, whatever interest they represent. So definitely a theme we'll continue to see. We hope to see the two houses work closely together on the policy moving forward instead of having two separate vehicles. The goal would be to get something on the ballot in 2022 for voters to approve. It's yet to be seen where the governor will be. It really will depend on the ability of the state to issue bonds at that moment in time of passage. He hasn't engaged quite yet, but obviously resilience is top of mind, because the bonds include so much for wildfire prevention and, of course, drought resilience. We're hoping that the time is right for this conversation, and we have made good traction in AB 1500 in particular. There is funding for the septic to sewer conversions that are, near and dear to our district. We're hoping to obviously increase that funding. So we'll continue to work with our delegation on asking them to do so. And then next slide. So as far as, legislation that we're actively working on with our trade association to amend or shelf this year, I will say so far these conversations have actually been quite fruitful in solving for some of the problems presented in the bills. And I think that's just because, we and our trade associations have come to the table with suggestions, with honest feedback on how to improve them. And, that really is the goal as we continue to build goodwill with these authors because they're, important authors. The first one is AB 377, which is authored by Assemblymember Robert Rivas out of the Salinas region, and then Senator Bob Hertzberg, who is the majority leader over in the Senate. This was called the California Clean Water Act, and it's sponsored by the Coast Keepers and environmental groups. It would require all California surface waters to be fishable, swimmable, and drinkable by January 2050. So it would change the way regional and state boards enforce compliance with water quality standards and ensure that waterways are taken off the impaired list. So, we're very concerned about this, just given some of the inconsistencies in the language and the what it could do to the current permit processing, some unintended consequences. So we've been pointing those out to our trade associations and working on amendments. Obviously, not all waters can be drinkable, and setting such a standard would be impossible to meet and very expensive. Also, we're not sure how this interplays with the governor's executive order calling for 30% of waterways to be considered by 2030. We're not sure that they're really working together on that. So, in initial conversations with the author, I think he realizes the bill is a huge undertaking, And we get the sense, you know, it could be more just a statement bill of, you know, this is our goal. We want to make improvements in this area. It is headed to the Assembly Environmental Safety and Toxic Materials Committee, which is chaired by Assembly Member Quirk. You know, so he's already pushing back on some of the policies and working to find common ground on what would just be more palatable to the water industry. And there have been a number of amendments to date. So, in fact, actually, one of the amendments will highlight, instead of you know, all surface water shall be swimmable, drinkable, and fishable by 2050, they've changed that language to now read all surface water shall attain applicable beneficial uses by 2050. So it doesn't quite have the same ring to it, but you know, we're making progress there nonetheless. And then SB 222 and 223 by Senator Dodd, you know, these are no surprise that, you know, we're seeing them this year. They're built to address just the pandemic and the impact it's had on ratepayers. So SB 222, this bill, it would require the state board to begin setting up rules for a water low-income rate assistance program, including how to distribute those funds. It would establish a fund for the program, though a funding source has not yet been identified and is not contained in the bill. So our teams have been working closely with our trade associations on very specific amendments, given their, you know, our major concerns about the water board being the entity to finance such a program. It's just not within their mission. They don't have a background in doing so. CMUA and others, we have asked for, you know, pages of amendments and have had good faith conversations with the author. You know, he really is digging into the policy and trying to be helpful in addressing some of these important issues that we have. So this also includes getting the program financed through the Department of Community Services and Development, whose scope is just much more germane to the administration of such a program. There's also been significant progress made on concerns around data sharing for water districts. So, of course, you know, also the concern is once a fund is established, you know, how is it going to get funded? According to his staff, Senator Dodd isn't necessarily supportive of a water tax or a public good charge at this time. You know, however, the ongoing concern is that, you know, once this fund is established, could some other author come back with a tax proposal next year to, you know, fill the coffers? So that's kind of weighing in the back of our minds and, you know, has to be part of the conversation. And then secondly, SB 223 by Senator Dodd, this would amend the SB 998 statute, which was a bill from a few years ago, also by Senator Dodd, to extend requirements related to shutoffs and bill repayments. As you guys know, the governor had put into place a moratorium on water utility shutoffs for as long as the COVID state of emergency is in place. So this bill would apply that same moratorium during any state emergency. It also waives disconnection and reconnection fees, puts other limitations on bill management plans and customer repayment windows. You know, there's a lot of concern about the reconnection fees and how that interplays with Prop 218 and, you know, potential cost-shifting concerns to other ratepayers. Also, there's just, you know, the water industry argues that there is no evidence that something like this is needed because all water districts to date have mostly been complying with the executive order. So given the requirements in SB 998 for establishing payment plans and other processes to avoid discontinuation of service, you know, it also is in the best interest of the water agency to initiate conversations early on before that customer has a large amount of debt. So that's something, you know, we've been trying to work and convey to the author. These bills are being pushed by the Community Water Center and other water agency groups, environmental justice groups. And then lastly, AB 1434 by Assemblywoman Friedman on the water use efficiency standards. So this bill, you know, unfortunately, it undoes the closely negotiated indoor standard by up to 10 gallons per capita per day, so 40 instead of 50. You might recall she authored the bill alongside Senator Hertzberg a few years ago. It was very closely negotiated. We were, you know, part of those conversations. So obviously that's a big concern. The 2018 bill package required DWR, excuse me, and the water board to conduct studies and investigations to jointly recommend to the legislature an indoor standard, which is important, you know, given that study has to take into account impacts to water and wastewater management, However, that study has not yet been released. So this bill, you know, we fear it jumped the gun on some of those conversations. Something in my throat. One second. All right, sorry about that. So again, the concern is the bill is getting ahead of that study, and you know, it undoes just those closely negotiated metrics that are, you know, really important given some of the considerations that decreasing that number from 50 to 40 could have on our wastewater system. And then last slide. So everybody's, you know, favorite topic, our ongoing efforts on the Small System Water Authority Act. As you guys know, we made great progress last year, worked really hard with the Water Board, with other stakeholders, to address as many of their concerns as possible and to streamline the process proposed in our bill and make it an actual workable tool for the Water Board so they could actually use it and solve the problem of, you know, small system water failures, you know, at its heart. So, unfortunately, some of that work we did also led to additional opposition from the LAFCOs, from CalMutual. The bill was ultimately held in Assembly Appropriations Committee, but we really feel that wasn't necessarily you know, due to the policy as much as it was on the tensions between the two houses. On the issue of water district consolidations especially, there was an assembly vehicle presenting a very specific geographic solution on this issue, which was not set for a hearing in the Senate. So it led for a dynamic that did not work in our favor. We took the time over the interim to work with stakeholders, including the Water Board, LAFCO, and ultimately came up with language that was accepted by all, which was, you know, a huge accomplishment. However, in order to move the bill forward, we truly feel that the Water Board needs to be a key to these efforts and to be on board in moving the vehicle. And for this reason, you know, we're currently exploring options on how we move forward, with making it a piece of legislation that can be, you know, without making it a piece of legislation that can be easily leveraged by one house or another. You know, it can't be something that's just being pushed back to the Senate and vice versa. So we're exploring those options, and we feel like we have a few. Because SB 200 funding, you know, in the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Fund is within the budget, our hope is that we align with that process ultimately. You know, there are a few other pieces of water consolidation legislation moving throughout the process this year, including one pushed by the environmental justice community, but it only addresses at-risk systems. And then there's also a bill that's very specific to the Southeast LA region and some of the issues that they have been having with one of the major water districts. So these vehicles will certainly be part of the discussion, and, you know, we'll have to continue our conversation with all stakeholders. But, you know, we do feel we've made progress and have momentum there, and, have finally language that's a very workable tool to get address the actual issue at hand. So we look forward to, you know, exploring what those options are and keeping you all apprised. So with that, we appreciate your time, and we're open for any questions.
Thank you very much. That's a very thorough presentation. I think the board appreciates it. Do any board members have any questions? Director Armstrong, are you on the line? Do you have any questions?
Thank you. I am on the line, but I don't have any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Danielle. Very excellent presentation.
Thank you. And thank you, Aaron and Jamie, for joining us today.
With that, we will go on to item 3 on our agenda, which is the general manager's report.
In the interest of time, I just have one quick item. Yesterday, we participated in the fifth rate refinement work group meeting up at the Metropolitan Water District. As you'll recall, Metropolitan has formed a rate refinement work group in process to find a replacement revenue source for the water stewardship charge, which has currently been suspended. The water stewardship charge funds all the water conservation programs as well as the local resource program agreements. So, again, this is the fifth meeting of the work group yesterday. We've been working with a group of 12 of the MET's member agencies to advance kind of the first step in the process, which is establishing policy principles for reevaluating the rates. Those were submitted, as well as several other member agencies, including San Diego and LADWP, submitted some policy principles. There was a very good discussion yesterday regarding those principles, and the group is very close, if not at consensus, on the policy principles going forward, including LADWP, and we had a really good conversation, and they were very engaged. So I think that's a good first step in this process to get the agencies on the same page. The next step is, and at the next meeting and at the next Met board meeting, they are going to give an overview of and background information just on demand management programs, on cost recovery and kind of functionalization of those cost recoveries. That'll go to the Met board and the work group in April. And then in May, they will bring the policy principles back to the Met board for consideration and adoption. So that's the overall schedule right now. So anyway, I just wanted to give a brief update on that. Thank you. Director Record, do you have a question?
Glad to hear that, but it sounds like, to me, it's gone better than I anticipated that it would.
Yeah, we did go through, and Met staff has, I think, done a good job trying to take comments from everybody. And LADWP had some really great comments, and Dave Pettyjohn participated yesterday, and there was good conversation back and forth. So I think we're a lot closer. Now, I won't say completely there, but San Diego still had some issues, but I think we're much closer than we were as far as a consensus product. That concludes my report. Thank you, Director Polly.
Very, very good. Laura, do you have anything for us this morning?
Nothing this morning.
Very good. Nick?
I did plan on giving a quick update on the latest claim from San Diego County Water Authority with regards to Met's and Eastern's inability to provide water supply to Fallbrook and Rainbow, and it's related to metropolitan member agencies' preferential rights. But again, I think in the interest of time and our full agenda, I might defer that to a future date.
Well, I'm sure that will hold to our next board meeting. Good morning, Joe. Do you have anything for us this morning?
Good morning. Nothing today.
Very good. And Mr. Wall?
Nothing today, Mr. President.
All right. That will take us to item 4 in our agenda, which is our consent calendar. Do any of the board members want to pull an item for further discussion or have a conflict on the consent calendar?
I would move the consent calendar.
Second. All right. Moved by Director Cronus, second by Director Record. May I have a roll call vote, please?
Director Polly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Very good. That passes 5-0. We will now move on to the action calendar, and we will move on to item A, which is to approve and authorize an interagency agreement with the Santa Ana River Conservation and Conjunctive Use Program, known as SARCUP. Excess Water Purchase Agreement between Eastern Municipal Water District, Western Municipal Water District, Inland Empire Utility Agencies, Orange County Water District, and the Municipal Water District of Orange County. Your timing is perfect.
That's right.
Good morning.
Has anything changed lately in this program? I mean, we're on track, right? Everything's going good?
Surprisingly on track, yes.
Okay.
And actually, this is a big step forward. We need an agreement from Met.
I'm just not sure we need a presentation on this. I think we're all very well versed on it. I'm happy to move the item.
Okay. It has been moved by Director Record. It has been seconded by Director Corona. I'm sure your presentation would have been outstanding.
I ran down here for nothing.
It's good exercise. Yes. May I have a roll call vote, please?
Director Polly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong? Director Armstrong?
We have Director Armstrong.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Now we can.
Sorry. I'm good.
Okay,
sorry.
Very good. The item passes 5-0.
Thank you, Director Records.
We'll move on to item B, which is to approve and authorize interagency agreement with the City of Hemet for the purchase of groundwater carryover credits. Good morning, Mr. Mawad.
Good morning, Mr. President, members of the board. We have discussed this item in the past with the board in closed session, so I will be fairly quick in covering the key provisions of this proposed agreement. As you're aware, the City of Hemet, along with Eastern, City of San Jacinto, and Lake Hemet, we are part of the Sepulveda Settlement Agreement, whereby we import raw water from Metropolitan for recharge in the San Jacinto Basin. The City of Hemet has certain carryover credits in the basin, and in fact, their accumulated carryover credits far exceed their annual demands. They are interested in selling or transferring a portion of their groundwater credits to us, and in turn, we are very interested in acquiring groundwater credits to help with our local water supply. So with that, we engage in discussions and negotiations with the city, and before you today is an agreement for your consideration. So just as a reminder, this Exhibit 3 shows that we currently serve a significant portion of the City of Hemet. Thus, the carryover credits that we are seeking to acquire, they will partially be utilized to serve the residents of the City of Hemet. Per the stipulated judgment, again, all the four parties that I mentioned participate in the recharge of the basin, and the unused groundwater credits, each party has the ability to sell or transfer a portion to another party. The key is that the transfer is subject to a first right of refusal by the water master. This is a very similar approach and arrangement that we entered into with the City of San Jacinto in 2018, where we acquired some of their carryover credits as well. So the considerations, again, as I mentioned, the city's current demand is slightly below 3,900 acre feet per year, whereas their portion of the unused pumping rights is 4,500 acre feet, plus the unused portion of the Sepulveda imported water. And those reside in two accounts. There's the adjusted base production account, where 65% of that water for the city resides, and about 35% of the city's credits reside in the unused Sepulveda tribe water. Thus, the transfers that we are proposing will be proportional from each of the accounts. In total, we are proposing to purchase 20,000 acre feet per year, and the transfers would occur annually, 2,500 acre feet over an 8-year period. Slide 6 represents a tabulation of the city's account. And what you'll see there is they're starting the year at approximately 24,000 acre feet. And the first rows, 2, 3, and 4, show you their available groundwater based on their portion of the adjusted base production right and the Sepulveda unused water. The bottom line is that with these 2,500 acre feet transfers, the city would still have significant amount of carryover credits in its account, above 15,000 acre feet. So although there's a slight reduction overall, they will have significant reserves in the ground. Slide 7 is really a graphical representation of what I just showed you. The blue columns represent the city's account as it accrues year after year without any type of transfers. The orange column represent the implementation of the transfer agreement, where there's a slight dip in their account, but then after the 8-year period, that would then resume in annual increases. So the pricing terms for this first year, the calculated amount would be approximately $1.9 million for the initial tranche of 2,500 acre feet per year. The fee is based on the current Sepulveda settlement replenishment rate, which is currently at $612. That is the rate established by Metropolitan. EMWD's delivery charge currently at $177. We also deduct the water master assessment, which is currently at $40, and that's set to be reduced to $35 next year. Those are the components of the rate that we have agreed to with the city, or we're proposing to agree to. There is a minimum escalation of 2% a year for the price of the water. That establishes a floor. Having said that, if any of those rate components were to exceed the 2%, then we would utilize the then-in-effect rate for the water. In total, over the 8-year periods, Based on the rate approach that I just described, we estimate the cost of the water will be approximately $16.3 million for the 20,000 acre feet. And slide 9 gives you a more detailed analysis of that water. I should mention that as you look at the above table, you'll see here the rates from the two different accounts, from the adjusted base production rice versus the unused saboba, of $749 an acre foot versus $789. One thing to consider is that when you add to that the pumping cost of approximately about $150 an acre foot, that total rate still is significantly below the full service treated water rate for Metropolitan, the Tier 1 rate of currently $1,166 an acre foot. So over the eight-year period, we stand to realize a savings of approximately $4.5 million associated with this agreement. Having said that, this also provides a significant revenue source for the city. They'll be able to use that to invest in their water system and upgrade their facilities. So some of the terms, as I mentioned, the transfers will occur proportionally from the city's account. The first transaction upon the board's approval of this agreement and the city's approval, and the city is currently scheduled to take up this agreement on April 13th, and all indication from the city manager is they will be supporting this agreement. The first transaction will effectuate in July of this year. Upon the board's approval of this agreement, as well as the city council's approval, we will be presenting this to the Water Master Board on May 24th, which is our next scheduled meeting. There is an option in the agreement whereby the city and Eastern can decide to extend the term of the agreement beyond 8 years. So, again, our next steps upon approval of this agreement, we will plan to execute the agreement, notify the Water Master, then present this item for, again, the consideration of their first right of refusal on May 24th. And if the Water Master declines, which, again, based on my discussions with the Water Master advisor, it appears that there's not an interest to effectuate their right of refusal. So then we'll effectuate the first transaction in July of this year. So our recommendation is to approve and authorize the agreement with the City of Hemet for purchase of their groundwater carryover credits. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
I just add one thing. The Water Master has also agreed that they will take the transaction for all years together. In other words, it'll be a one-time approval by the Water Master for the entire transaction, not an annual approval.
Thank you, Paul.
Any questions for Joe? No, I just wanted to say I know this is a long time coming, good work on this. One question I already know the answer to, but for the record, this will not affect the City of Hemet's participation on the Water Master, correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
That will not change at all.
Very good. Any questions from Director Armstrong?
Oh, great.
No questions.
Do I have a motion?
I move it just, and also, just, commendation to staff. This is a win-win. It's great for the city and great for us. So,
absolutely.
Really good. Yeah.
Moved by Director Record.
I'll second it.
Second by Director Slauson. May I have a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Thank you.
The item is approved 5-0. And before we take a break, we'll do item C, which is to approve and authorize award of contracts to Lenin Christian Company for $4,032,000. Jacobs for $875,000 for the drilling and testings of well 206, 207, and 208, an additional appropriation of $5.8 million. Good morning.
Good morning, President.
You now have an opportunity to present it to the board.
You know, I took this because I didn't have my prior opportunity. So, again, good morning, President Pauly and members of the board. It's with great pleasure this morning that I'm introducing to you Tom Henderson. Tom is our new principal engineering geologist. He's been on board now for a few months. He has worked worldwide in his previous employment in well oversight, well drilling, and design, and providing technical expertise. So we feel really fortunate to have him as part of the team, and I'm happy for him to give his first presentation to you this morning.
Very good. Good morning, Mr. Henderson.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. Thank you for having me. As Linnea said, I'm the district's new principal engineering geologist. And what I want to talk about today is specifically the Paris North groundwater program, and even more specifically wells 206, 207, and 208. Next slide, please. Oh, that's my job. Thank you. So just as a large-scale overview, I'm sure many of you are familiar with the Paris North program, and this specifically is for three wells. If you look specifically, though, at the second and third bullets, those are more aligned with the large-scale objectives of the program. We have non-point sources of contamination that can be treated, and the benefit to the district is a reliable, low-cost source of water supply. Okay, and I skipped a little ahead. Now, this map shows two primary areas of concern. You have Moreno Valley, you have the Cactus Corridor area, as well as the south area. Those are encompassed in those two crosshatched areas. And so you see several wells on that. Just want to point out the wells at the very top in a circle. That's wells 65 and 66. They're currently under construction. And the two boxes, the two gold boxes, include wells 206 and 207. Those are also known as the Cactus Corridor North wells. And then in the gold box on the bottom, that's well 208, which is one of the two Cactus Corridor East wells. Go to the next slide. And these are some aerial views of the location of these wells. So in the orange box that's on this slide, that is where we have two wells on the same parcel. That's wells 206 and 207. Again, that's in the Moreno Valley, North wells for the Cactus Corridor. And then well 208, which is located in a permanent easement on the City of Moreno Valley maintenance yard. And just want to talk about the well design for these three wells. I think what's of most interest or notable for the district is for wells 206 and 207, the target production rate is on the order of 500 gallons per minute. Obviously, we're going to maximize that to the extent possible. And the target depth is quite a bit shallower than what you might see on the east side of the basin, sort of in the San Jacinto area. That's wells 206 and 207. Well, 208.
Question, please?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry about that, but isn't that kind of low production?
Well, it is, and so some of this, my understanding, was based on what the numerical model said could be produced. As a point of reference, I can tell you in well 65, which we're in the process of testing right now, we're seeing pumping rates as much as 1,400 gallons a minute for a design rate of 700. And so until you install the well, you know, using the best practices for the design and whatnot, you really don't know what the production rate will be. And so 65 is a great example of the productivity of the well being much better than anticipated. The good news is that leads to lower pumping costs for the district, that sort of thing, higher well efficiency.
Okay, thank you.
I think one thing I could add, Dr. Record, to your point, as you may recall, the area has fairly shallow bedrock. That's one of the reasons why the area has shown over the years very elevated groundwater conditions. So we are trying to treat the commingled plumes, recognizing that some wells are going to be advanced in with limited alluvial production areas, whereas some of the well that Tom is going to talk about next, is in a deeper canyon section. So, but to your point, you're absolutely right. This is relatively low production.
I mean, we wouldn't go out and drill a well for this kind of production unless there was another situation that we're trying to correct.
Absolutely. This is not necessarily ideal. That's why we needed the state to help fund this program. Absolutely.
Yeah, and it is trying to get the capture zone for the contaminants as well as take care of the rising or address the rising groundwater condition that's trapped on this shallow shelf. But as Joe pointed out, the next well is in kind of an incised canyon, subterranean canyon, and it's going to be much deeper for a different set of reasons. So they're kind of designed to the subsurface geology.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. So, as was just mentioned, this third well of the three is down to 720 feet. That's the target depth based on the information that was available. Of course, we go out and verify what we see with the pilot hole drilling. Any other questions? I'll go to the next slide. So it's important to talk about the bids that we received, the three bids. Two of the three were within 10% of the engineer's estimate. I have worked with all three of them, and all three of them are reputable drilling companies who are familiar with our specs and are capable of meeting those expectations. In addition, we solicited competitive proposals from five firms that are on our as-needed list. Three of those firms elected not to propose due to staff resource limitations, and the other two, Water Systems Consulting, got together with Jacobs Engineering as a sub-consultant. The proposal that they submitted for the proposal that we negotiated to $875.96 is consistent with the oversight fees that we are currently executing for 65, 66, and 204. Here's a little more detail on the scope of services. And so when we're actually conducting this drilling and construction, it's much like any other construction job. Having inspection there yields benefits, and that's quality control benefits, ensuring that the district's interests are protected, not just from a design of the well perspective, but also a bigger picture safety perspective and quality control. And so there's a detail there of some of the specific things that go into that. What's unique about the Paris North program is that we're doing things that we wouldn't typically do for a production well. That includes air monitoring for the presence of volatile organic compounds, PPE that may be required associated with the drilling in the non-point source contaminated area. So with that, our recommendation is to award and execute a contract with Lane Christensen of Redlands, California, for construction of wells 206, 207, and 208 in an amount not to exceed $4,032,345, and award and execute a contract with Jacobs Engineering Group for the professional hydrogeologic construction management and testing services for those same wells, for an amount not to exceed $875,976, and then also administrative and execution of other contracts necessary for the construction of the wells, and ultimately additional appropriation of $5,876,000, which will bring the total program appropriation to $29,596,56. Any questions?
Any questions from board members? Director Armstrong, any questions on this item?
I have no questions.
Very good. I will look for a motion and a second, please.
I'll make that motion.
Second.
Moved by Director Corona, second by Director Record. May I have a roll call, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And the item passes 5-2-0. With that, we will take a 10-minute break. Okay.
Thank you.
We will re-adjourn our meeting. We will move on to our informational items. We've already done item C this morning. On item A, I will ask the board in respect to our time this morning, because I know we have a budget workshop coming up. Is there any questions? Does anyone have any questions on the operating highlights or capital highlights that they would like answered, or could we move on to item B?
I'd kind of like to just dive into the workshop myself.
Okay. Director Armstrong, anything on the operational highlights?
No, I say dive into the budget workshop.
Okay. I have consensus on that. So with that, Mr. Adams, good morning. We are going to dive into the budget workshop.
Yes, good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. So I'm the lucky one that gets to do full presentation, and I will take my time going through it. All right, sounds good. Thank you, Lance. So again, good morning. So this is workshop number two for the board, and I really plan to provide you a preliminary budget overview. With that, we do have some proposed preliminary rate increases that we're going to recommend. As you know, the budget is really a key document for our resource allocation, and the strategic plan really does play a key role in the development of this two-year budget and our five-year capital plan. So here's the agenda for today. I wanted to just briefly do a recap on workshop number one, in which we talked about some assumptions and really just highlight a few key points that I think you'll understand as we go through this presentation, the impacts on this year's budget. Then I plan on going through the preliminary expenditure overview. This will be at the consolidated level, so you will see expenses in the major categories from operating expenses to CIP, and from OFA. With that said, I'm going to drill down a little on water purchases, discuss a little about personnel costs and some of the drivers there, and then talk about the pension obligation. And then next, provide you operational services summaries, or what we call our service area summaries, which is really water, wastewater, and recycled. Talk about the major variances in the major categories. From there, jump into operating fixed assets and our capital improvement program. I did have a summary on CIP. A lot of it is covered in the second quarter, and especially on the overall five-year plan. And then next, want to talk briefly about rehab and refurbishment, about the efforts that we have made over the last 5 years related to modeling that and planning accordingly. And then next, rate adjustment. I will show you the proposed rate adjustment. There's actually two scenarios, which I will talk about later. One that includes increasing the capital charge to help with the R&R. And then finally, provide a schedule and then open it up for discussions with the board. With that said, if you have questions as I go through it, please ask. All right. My mouth is already dry. So here's the calendar. As I mentioned, workshop number one was last month. This is workshop two. Really, the focus is the preliminary budget. I'll cover CIP, OFA, and then the preliminary rates. In 5 weeks, April 21st, we'll bring together, based on feedback from the board, a draft summary budget book with rate summaries, and then get direction to mail Prop 218 notices, and then set the public hearing for June. So really key highlights from the workshop number one. Operating expenses, relatively consistent. This year it's about 49%, but overall half of the budget is in our operating expenses. And within that, 80% is personnel and purchase water. And that's really why I talk about personnel and purchase water. Staffing, if you remember, I showed you a 10-year history, which really only showed a 2% growth over the 10 years. Really, staffing has remained flat, even though the district has grown. We did talk a lot about COVID-19 and the impacts on the budget. I'm not going to spend much time talking about that. There's really two major areas, at least, that we list here. The increase in the accounts receivable, and that continues to increase each month. And then the suspension of late fees. And that has an impact on this budget. That's about $4 million. And then anticipated first year next year, about $2 million, with us reinstating it in the second year. And then I mentioned the EMWD or the MW Met Water increases of 4% and 5%. Then CIP funding for the next 2 years, $90 million and $95 million roughly. And then we talked a little about OPEB, the success that we've had with funding OPEB, and the likelihood that it's going to be at 100% by the end of this year. And then finally, I did mention pension liability. I do have a slide for that, which I plan to show you the liability and potential options for funding that. All right. Hmm. Let me get back to my notes. So for the preliminary expenditure overview, I plan to show you operating and non-operating expenditures at the consolidated level, provide some information on personnel expenses, purchase water, and potentially additional contributions to pay down the liability. All right. So here is the summary on expenditures. This is really the high level for the agency as whole. The first year budget is $445 million, where operating expenses represent about 49%. Of a few slides, as I mentioned earlier, on the actual service areas that we'll actually go in detail on. For CIP, the overall for CIP is $184 million. This is the net amount based on grants, and so we're getting about $35 million in grant funding, which is about 18%. For debt service, you'll see an increase in year one at $3.1 million, but it flattens out in the second year. Next, for operating fixed assets, the increase or the funding for that is going to be $54 million over the next 2 years. This is very similar to the funding over the past couple years, and so I'll have a table that shows you that those comparisons over the last 4 years. The next G&A. Sorry, I should go back. Previous. G&A expenses on average are increasing 5.2%, mainly driven by increase in labor and personnel costs. For pension and OPEB, in this budget, we at least preliminary are recommending maintaining funding levels very similar to this year's OPEB contribution, $19 million. I have a slide again that I'll talk a little about that and the potential benefits to EMWD for continuing that $19 million as we move forward. So if you look in the right-hand bottom corner, you'll see the overall increase over the 2 years is 3.3%. When you look at it on a year one, it's only 2.5%, and then there's a 4% increase in the second year. And that's sort of the basis for the recommendation related to the rate increase for the year one, which typically is going to be 2.5% in year one and 3% in year two. All right, next slide. This one, what I want to start first with is to show you purchase water. Again, one of our largest cost components on the operating side. We did talk about the 4% and the 5% at MET. What I'm showing you in the first table is really our projections based on purchases and local production in 2021. I think really the key points for 21-22 and 22-23 is you will see a reduction in purchased amounts, whether that is going to be from MWD, from MET Water, or based on the agreement that you approved earlier from the city of Hemet. With that said, we do see a decrease in year one, and that is, as you can see, is the desalter production is going to increase up to 14,400 acre feet based on the new desalter coming online. And then well production currently is projected at 13,300. This is a decline from the current projections, but very in line with prior years when you look at that 14,000, ranging between 12 and 14,000. So just to give you a sense of what the purchase and production are going to be and the availability of the supply. With that said, in the right-hand corner, you see the calculation based on MET rates. The increase is only $1.5 million, but that's because, and it's only a 2.1% increase, but that's because we have purchased less water. Now, I will note one of the other points I want to make is purchased replenishment water. This number is going to be revised. My understanding is right now we're projecting zero in year one and 3,500 in year two. So that will be revised in the final budget. That will reduce our overall purchases in year one and the cost, but will increase the purchases in year two. All right.
John.
Yes,
John,
Jeff.
This is, can I ask you a quick question on that slide?
Yes, Jeff.
Just if you could clarify, you mentioned the Hemet groundwater carryover credits. Are those included in your forecast, or are those not in those numbers?
Currently, it is not. But let me clarify, and I'll look to Joe to help me a little. So on the purchase water, ultimately, the city of Hemet would that $1.8 million or the approximate $800 an acre foot would be part of the purchase water that is in that $68,464. So that would ultimately reduce the amount that we're paying Met Water, but again, paying it to City of Hemet. And so that those costs will go down, the purchase water. I believe it's about $250 an acre foot. So at the $2,500, you can do the math, it's about $750,000, $800,000 a year. So that will be, when you see the next projection in April, that will be adjusted accordingly. Does that help?
Yeah, that's helpful. Thanks.
Okay. So the next slide, again, personnel expenses, almost 50% of the operating costs. I really want to highlight a couple items here. First, as I mentioned, there's four new positions proposed in this budget, two for GIS analysts and two for electric apprentices. Initially, in the first workshop, I suggested that it was three in year one and two, and one in year two. The electric apprentices will actually be in year two. So the allocation is one position, GIS analyst, in the first year, and then the three in the second year. But ultimately, the financial impact, the annualized financial impact, is almost $600,000 for those new four positions. Also, cost of living adjustments per the MOUs, or the ones that are potentially being negotiated, 2% each year. The impact on this year's budget, or this 2 years budget, is approximately $2 million for that cost of living adjustment, which would be effective January of each of the calendar years. And then merit increases, currently budgeted at 2.5% a year. Approximately 50% of the employees are at top step, or what we consider the control point, and would not be eligible for merit increase. So 50% are and 50% are not. Just quickly, two other major drivers for personnel costs: medical. The two-year impact is $1.1 million. It's about $550,000 each year. And then pension contribution, the UAL, the increase in year one is $1.7 million, and then in second year, $1.2 million. So that also has a significant increase on our personnel costs.
Director Record.
Yeah, how do you estimate the COLA?
So assuming our base is around $65 million. So 2% on $65 million is $1.3 million. Problem is you have 6 months in which you don't have that COLA. So it's 6 months.
Do you mean the calculation itself?
How do you come up with 2%?
Oh, well, that would, I'm sorry, it's right now we're basing it on the average on CPI, and I think last year it was about 2.1.
Yeah, and Director Record, it's an embedded formula in the MOU, which uses a certain designated CPI. It's a Riverside, that's characteristic of this area. So that was negotiated into the MOU. So it is what it is. We think it's tracking around 2%.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
That's okay.
The actual calculation versus the index in which we use, which is, as Paul said, stated in the MOU.
Laura Zamora tracks it monthly as it is reported, and we keep track of it because I think of the MOU we have to use as of November, the rate as of November.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know if it was something that was predetermined as far as the formula or something that you just decided. I think it's going to be about 2. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Got it.
Sure.
Then I had a yes. Quick question too on the medical. Is that $1.1 million over the 2 year budget?
It is
per year.
It is. We spend about $11 million roughly currently on healthcare district wide, including retirees. So that is $1.1 over the 2 year, or $550,000
okay.
a year average.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I should have clarified that a little. So I highlighted the significant increase that we have in our unfunded liability payments. And I did show this graph at the workshop, and so just showing it again, that even though we have made our required contributions, and those required contributions on the liability have increased, as you know, regularly on an annual basis, that our funded status continues to remain around 70%. Sort of as we have, you know, addressed the issue with OPEB and accelerated funding for that, we have been very successful in getting that close to 100% funded. It would certainly be to our advantage to sort of start addressing the pension liability as we have really addressed the OPEB liability. So this slide is very similar to what I provided to you at the first workshop. There are really two main options for the board's consideration or for this agency, and I should actually say three. We can continue to do make the annual payments as required by the actuary report, or we can take an approach to try to pay off for that liability faster. The first one is a fresh start, and the fresh start is really just taking the outstanding 154 and amortizing it over a 15-year period. This would increase our annual payment by about $4 million, and ultimately would save the district $38 million. The other one, which is what we are currently recommending, and in really in matching the funding that we've provided for OPEB over the last 4 to 5 years, is to continue this with the pension funding. And so, as you see, we're recommending to continue that $19 million contribution to address this long-term liability. We did, after last workshop, have a brief discussion with CalPERS to get, you know, projections on the 5 to 10 year, how we can pay it off in between 5 and 10 years, and that's really the table below. And so you can see in the red box I've highlighted, if you maintain funding on additional payments of $19 million, you can pay that off in 6 years and ultimately save the district, assuming, again, assumptions, return on investment, in, you know, at least projected $96 million. So, again, as this liability continues to grow, you know, we are paying for that assumed discount rate.
I think that's an important point, because we have in the current budget, in our current operating budget, that $19 million to pay off the OPEB liability, which, as you recall, this board committed to about 8 years ago, and we are now going to be and projecting to be 100% funded this year. So we're suggesting taking that same rate of contribution for these outstanding employee liabilities and now shifting that over to address this CalPERS liability. So it essentially would take that revenue source and put it towards the CalPERS liability. And we could, target based on this target, have a six-year drawdown of that where we're fully funded. And if you think about that, within 12 years, the board will have gone from, you know, a very significant potential liability for all those things to fully funded. So we think it's a very sound strategy. Doesn't have a budget impact per se, because we are already putting aside that money for that purpose. It would just shift it for the pension liability purpose.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when looking at the fresh start and the ADP, is the benefit of the ADP is that certainly it's discretionary every year. So right now, as Paul said, it's built into the budget. We can continue. But if something from a budgetary side has a significant impact on the district, we can skip a year and not pay it or reduce it. So it provides a lot of flexibility for future boards and, you know, to anticipate other changes in the budget.
Any questions on that?
Yeah. All right. So my next two slides, I'm going to go through the service areas in detail. Really just talk to the tables and talk about the major variances. One of the things I want to say as we look at these, it's very difficult when you see variances in the first year compared to the current budget. If you would have had the update on the second quarter report, you will see in some cases revenues or expenditures are trending in a certain way. And so when we developed the budgets at the service levels, we're not taking just the current budget and applying a percentage. We're actually looking at the trending and then what we are seeing as far as changes in revenues and expenses. The first item I'm going to discuss, you'll see that the percentage increase is significantly higher, but that is because our assumptions that were done 2 years ago are not the same as they are today. So the first one is water service, and I'll start off with revenues and specifically domestic water and demand charges. And as I said, you see a 12.5% increase in revenues in the first year. That is not because we are raising rates, 12.5%. The reason is that we have assumptions that were done 24 months ago that assume certain growth, that assume certain demands, and that has changed. So of that 12.5%, and I need to look at my notes, the difference in growth that we currently have versus what we had 2 years ago was 4%, and then demand has also increased over 5%. So a lot of that increase is, one, the increase in demand and the increase in growth, and those are two separate items. When we look at irrigation, again, you ask why the significant decrease of over $6 million. And we have one major customer that has not taken irrigation for, I think, the last 2 years. But right now that is trending significantly lower. And so based on the trending in the sales, we're seeing we're projecting a decrease. Now, again, there's the offsetting of the costs related to that water and the purchases. But, again, $3 million versus a $9 million budget. With that, I'm moving down to operating expenses. We talked earlier about the purchased water costs. You see that 2.1% increase in year one. That assumes, really a reduction in the amount of purchased water that we would be doing, but then also applies the 4% increase. Now, that number, again, doesn't currently include the differential between the City of Paris water, nor does it anticipate the change that I would anticipate between now and the final related to replenishment water. Groundwater replenishment O&M, a significant decrease in year one. That is really trending, it's really a change in expenses in the trending. So last year we spent about $402,000. It's on track to spend about that this year, so we made adjustments in the budget. And then you see the modest increase in year two. Just want to make sure I keep up with my notes. So O&M, you see a large increase there. About $600,000 of that increase is related to the new desalter coming online. So Paris 2 coming online really attributes to much of that increase. You see energy, significant increase in energy. $1 million is attributed to the Paris 2 desalter for next year. Going down to allocated support costs, so during this budget cycle, finance staff reviewed our time entry system and the way staffing was allocated. And so we allocate staffing either based on service area, department level, or capital projects. And so that change is really a change from how staffing is being allocated, service areas versus departments versus capital. And so even though a large percentage of that allocated supported cost is related to labor and the increase related to labor, an equally large portion is related to the way that we allocate staffing. And that's based on actuals. I mean, people currently enter their time and assign it to one of those three areas. And then finally, G&A, we're working still on our allocations. You'll see this consistent in all three of the service areas. We're projecting a 3% change from prior year, but this will be refined as we bring the final budget to the board. All right. Wastewater services, very similar on the revenue side. We're only proposing a 2% increase in wastewater and a 3% in the second year. But trending from revenues right now in the current budget are higher than the budget estimates. So the 2021-22 budget has been adjusted accordingly. I talked earlier about what percentage of the increase is related to growth versus versus the rate increase. And so one is only 1% of that rate increase is related to, or 1% of the increase is related to the rate. The other 5% is related to growth. I'll move down to operating expenses. So starting with the recycled disposal, this is the charge for the charge that goes over to recycling. So this is the transfer. So currently it's allocated at 2.85% of revenue. This goes to help support the wastewater, or I'm sorry, the recycling service, and shown as a revenue, and you'll see that on the other side. So for collections, really the decrease in year one is related to that reallocation of labor. That there was a difference of about $350,000 in year one related to labor. Then you see the modest increase in year two at 2.8. Treatment does have a reduction. The major reduction there, and really goes to the trending that we're seeing in the wastewater, is a reduction in chemical costs. Currently, we're trending well below budget and the forecast of 2 years ago. The impact in treatment is about $720,000 for next year, and then you see an increase in the second year. The other thing that's there is the fuel cells. The maintenance agreements expire, at the end of this calendar year, but the overall impact on an annualized basis is about $800,000. So you're seeing some decreases in that area. Next, energy. So there's two things really going on here. One, the initial budget 2021 anticipated SE credits that were all used up prior to this year. So we are seeing the trending in energy costs in the wastewater fund higher than the budget of $5 million. That number is $1.3 million. So you go from $5 million up to $6.3. The additional $700,000, we're projecting about 10% in purchase electricity costs from Southern California Edison. So that really makes up, you know, that delta between $5 and $7 million. Next, I got sludge and sludge hauling. You know, the decrease, this one does fluctuate year to year based on maintenance. And so in the second year, that increase is related to cleaning of three digesters. I believe one is at Temecula Valley and two is at Moreno Valley. And then I mentioned earlier just allocated costs and G&A, very similar. The increases are very similar on both water and wastewater. And really for allocated support costs, it's the allocation of labor plus the increase in labor costs. All right, recycled water. And I'll talk a little about the proposed rate increase for recycled water. Rates are proposed to increase between 3 and 7%. The net effect based on that increase plus what we're seeing in the slight increase in demand is an overall 4.5% increase in total revenue. With that, recovery projects, this is the local resource the local credits from MWD. This is related to the expansion of the recycled water system. Based on the sliding scale, we only anticipate receiving a little under $500,000 this year, so we're going to be under target for that $700,000. And then in the first year, we're only expecting $142,000 currently, and then zero in year two. So that, you'll see, has a significant impact on the overall performance of the fund, where you see a decrease in the net operating revenue at the bottom. With that, Let me move on to the first item, which is, let me just talk about the wastewater cut for wastewater customers. So this is the revenue coming over from the wastewater fund, that $3.3 million in year one and $3.4 in year two. Transmission, just a modest increase in year one of 5.4 and then 1.7 in year two. Current year is trending very close to the budget, maybe slightly over. As far as our next one, pumping, that increase is really direct, is direct labor, just in a change of the allocation that I had mentioned earlier, that increase from current year to the first year of 7.7% is related to direct labor. For energy, I mentioned that purchased energy is a 10% increase, but it is offsetted with the new solar that's coming online. Storage is showing a decline in year one, and again, same thing. In this area, we're seeing, you know, reduction based on just scheduled maintenance, and so that really is happening in year one, and then the increase in year two. And then, of course, I mentioned allocated supported costs. That's just the way that labor is being reallocated to the department level and not directly to the service area. And then I did mention the net operating revenues are less than prior year, and that's really, really attributed to the $700,000 reduction in LRP credits from MWD. So next I'm going to briefly go through our preliminary OFA and capital improvement plan. I'm not going to spend much time on the capital improvement plan. Part of the capital update today had some good updates on our overall five-year plan, but I will provide a summary. So here's our schedule for operating fixed assets. I know the table's a little busy. The purple is really meant to show you what the prior year was, both for new funding and then what the current budget is, which is includes the carryover. You'll see on that purple column to the right, our current budget in OFA is about $38 million. The next two-year budget, certainly has significant investments in IT and then just our normal operations and maintenance, replacement and fixed asset improvements. So there you'll see that number is very consistent, where if you look at the prior 2 years at about $25 million on average, this first year, 26, and then 27. You know, just to highlight a few things, in that second year, that's the $27 million, we do have at least initial placeholder for the ERP and development services systems at $15 million. That's a very preliminary number, but very similar to what we've seen in the cost of the COIN system. So next, just a very high level on the five-year capital plan. So total budget is, or at least currently the plan is $545 million. That includes this year and 4 years out. Benefit is almost $96 million is from external funding, which is about 18%. The five-year plan has about $68 million per year in investments in water, $35 million in sewer. I do highlight a couple of the top projects, and certainly Parish North Base groundwater program is the most significant over the next 2 years. As you know, about 50% of that is going to be external funding, so that's really good news. I just highlight the other four top projects, and the Parish 2 to Salter is really the remaining portion of that, which I show at the top. And that bar graph is just to show you the distribution between water, sewer, recycling, and others, which is really buildings for administration stuff. So this is a table to show you the five-year allocation. Really, it's broken up into two areas. One, expansion and betterment. And we show it based on the categories, water, sewer, recycle, general. Certainly right now, $72 million in the current year with 42, and you see at the bottom where we show about $30 million in grant funding. For the first year, very similar numbers with the net being a little less. Grants, about $19 million, and then in year two, about $94 with $16.7 million in grants, $16.8. But you can see that, larger portion in expansion and betterment, mainly supported either by grants or connection fees. Right now, the allocation, when you look at the total 5 years, about 63% is expansion or betterment related, or 37% is replacement related. So close to two-thirds, one-thirds allocation. Just to note, certainly we have about $4 billion in capital assets, and I always put annual depreciation, certainly $100 million every year. So I'm going to spend a few slides talking about rehab and replacement, as that number, at least from a CIP, has increased over time as we have aging infrastructure. And sort of important for from a planning side, as we have aging infrastructure that certainly in some cases is coming up on 80 years, that we start planning and trying to really plan accordingly. So I know EMWD has done significant work over the last 4 to 5 years. As the sort of slide says, American Water Works Association, one of the top concerns for individuals in the water industry is aging infrastructure. And so back in 2017, staff completed what we call our R&R planning model, which is really us compiling all of the assets that EMWD had and calculating the long-term financial obligation. So we've done that analysis. We have great records on the assets that we own and those original costs. So just a quick history on assets. So what I'm highlighting in the circle, in the graph, the bar graph at the bottom, is assets that were installed prior to 1985. So the count, 70,000 assets were done before 1985. So certainly we're talking, 35 plus years ago, and all the way back to the 50s. The value of that, those assets today, the replacement value is $2.4 billion, and broken up between the water system, sewer, and recycled water. So the model that predicts what our costs and the model predicts what our costs would be when you put these assets in. And so we are using this output, and I'll talk about the output, is we're using a 100-year forecast to predict the costs in replacing these assets. And so the number I highlight there is the $89 million. In order, if you take the assets that we currently have through 2017 and then use the model to predict what the cost would be over the next 100 years, as many of our assets have a useful life, 100 years, pipes in the ground, the cost annualized would be $89 million. On the graph at the bottom, you see the line that shows you that $89 million annualized over the 100 years. Certainly right now, and that's on the left-hand side, that number is less. It's in the 40s, and so currently we are funding what those requirements are. But over time, you can see there are some peaks based on major facilities and with the need of those to be replaced. So our current investment strategy on R&R. So as I mentioned, we're spending about $40 million per year, but as you can see from the prior graph, replacement costs fluctuate from year to year, certainly showing the peaks and valleys. And so by discussing setting up a reserve would certainly help smooth rates and avoid any shock in the rate increases. Certainly, the contributions in the reserve can be ramped up over time. What we're proposing is a modest increase or an establishment of a reserve, but also just a modest increase in our capital charge, our monthly capital charge. And so, you know, a reserve like this could be used with our current funding, which a lot of it's pay as you go, also to utilize debt financing as well. So the thought process would be to establish the additional capital charge to support the RMR reserve. I should go next. So I'm going to jump into preliminary rate adjustments, and I'm going to also show you the impacts on the consolidated budget, both revenues and expenses, and then show how it impacts our overall net operating margins. I did mention earlier that overall, based on these rate increases, the average for a residential customer would be 2.5% in year one and 3.5% in year two, which I'll show you in a slide. So initially, proposal is a 2% increase in our commodity rate. The daily service charge would increase by 60 cents a month, which is a 4.2% increase. Our capital charge without the R&R funding would be 20 cents per EMS, and that's a 20% increase each year. The $4.20, which is the current rate, would be $4.40 a month starting January 1st. Ag water, continued implementation of the multi-year phase-in, and then wholesale adjust rates for the full pass-through. For sewer, this one's a little easier. We're just recommending a 2% in year one for the daily service and 2% in the capital fixed charge. And then in the second year, we're recommending a 3% increase in both daily and capital. And then recycled water, I mentioned it earlier, increases vary based on class. They range from 3% to 7%. Are in line with our cost of service study that was done in 2017. So here's our consolidated budget statement. The first one is operating revenues. I talk a little about that 2.5% increase in year one and 3.5% in year two. This is the change in not just the revenue from the rate increase, but the change in some of the assumptions related to growth and demand. Let me go back. I wanted to just briefly highlight a couple things on revenues, and so I'm going to apologize for that. Property tax, you will see a large increase in property tax from the current budget to the first year budget. This is mainly due, one, to the trending. Currently, we're trending to about $47 million. This is because there has been an increase in money that we have been receiving. Additional property taxes related to the elimination of redevelopment agencies. And so this year, that number is about $7.2 million. So that has been included based on the trending in next year's budget. So we're projecting over $49 million. For connection fees, really just anticipating that to stay flat. Again, as there's increases in that revenue, that really is reserved for capital improvements. Expansion projects, and so we're really anticipating 3,000 as our standard calculation, 3,000 EMSs and 3,000 EDUs, with an increase with the 2.5% increase assumed based on the ENR. Interest income, I didn't mention this earlier. This is one of the impacts on COVID for us. Certainly, the original budget was anticipating a 2.5% increase in interest rates or return on investments. We are currently only anticipating or projecting 0.75% aggregate on our investments over the next year, and then increasing that to 100 basis points or 1% in year two. Net margin, which just to talk about net margin, you can see the numbers there, $59 million in year one and $67 in year two. Overall, we have capital commitments, which is OFA, and capital projects at $134 and $139 in years one and two. And that is, of course, less grants. Once you reduce it by net operating margin, you reduce capital grants, then you the rest comes out of either debt or reserves. Currently, we don't anticipate, based on this, doing any debt issuance in the next 24 months based on current reserves and current bond proceeds that are on hand. So this is the typical bill for a residential customer. Certainly in the commodity, you see the 2% in year one and 3% in year two. Mentioned the daily service charge going up 60 cents per month from $13.80 to $14.40 up to $14.85 in the second. Capital charge, 20 cents per month, $4.20 to $4.40. So ultimately, you know, an increase on the water bill and then sewer is 2% in the first year and 3% in the second year. You can see the change, assuming a typical water bill at $106, increasing to $108.83, which is a 2.5% increase, and in the second year it's a 3% increase. So this is the additional scenario with an R&R fund contribution, and I'll show you the consolidated statement after I go through this. So recommendation to fund, start building up an R&R reserve to help with the increase in future R&R cost. We're recommending a total of 80 cents, which would be an additional 60 cents for an R&R reserve. You can see the numbers there. So in the first year, going from 420 up to 500. And then sewer, very similar, where the current rate increases 55 cents would be increased to 48 cents in each year. So taking it from 275 up to 330. The overall incremental impact on the customer, and I'll show you that on the next slide, is 1%. And again, this assumes that the base rate scenario continues. So this is the consolidated. I'm only going to really highlight the two things, and this is really the change, the increase in the operating revenues in year one and year two. And then, as you can see really by this, because of the rate increase going into effect January 1 of each year, the first year it's $1.3 million would be contributed to the reserve. And then 4.1 in the second year. Nothing else changes. If we, you know, the outside of the operating revenues, certainly by putting the money aside in reserve, it doesn't change your net margin, doesn't necessarily change your use of reserves, and does not have an impact on that. So here's the bill, a typical water bill for water and sewer for one of our customers. You can see it, and I won't go through it, but I highlighted the capital charge going from $4.20 up to $5, and then the capital charge going from $2.75 to $3.30. Overall, you can see that increase in the red box, 3.5% in year one and 4% in year two. I did annualize the impact for the benefit of the board to show, because on the prior slides, you only saw the 6 months and then the 12 months.
I had a question.
Yeah.
So you're not identifying the R&R in the bill, in an actual bill? I'm bringing it up because I think that might be beneficial.
I think
public know that you are putting it, setting aside.
As an identifier on the capital charge?
Yeah. I
is that what you're suggesting?
Like when they get their bill, every month they get a bill and it says, okay, this you're paying for this and you're paying for this and you're paying for this.
Yeah, right.
And is there a line item in that bill for R&R?
Not yet.
Not currently.
Currently it just says the capital charge.
Correct.
But it's certainly...
I think that might be beneficial.
Because
people say... The hell is this capital CIS charge? System. What do I get in that capital charge? And then you're telling them this is.
We would need
R&R.
Yeah, we could do it. We just need to program the system to break it out. And obviously, we're going through a implementation right now. So, but that would be something that we could do.
Okay. Yeah, I would concur with Director Corona. I think the the more plain and simple we make our billing for our customers and explain to them what their billing is going to, the happier customers we have.
Well, I think with the new CIS system, yes, it's obviously a substantial improvement over our existing mm-hmm. system in terms of flexibility on what the bill displays and so forth. So, you know, we're getting that up. Our go-live date's right around the corner. So
I understand. I'm just saying as a policy, I think the more clear we can make our billing Agreed. To our customers, and I don't think people mind paying for the fact that we're rehabilitating our system. When I look around Southern California and see almost daily water breaks in Los Angeles, I think people realize that we keep our system up to date and we don't have those problems. So,
great suggestion. And
we can definitely look into that.
Other kind of questions mm-hmm. and discussion? I think we kind of want to open it up at this point.
Yeah, this is just
John,
the...
John. I know you want to go through the...
No. I was just going to follow Paul. Five short weeks, we'll be back in front of you. And as Paul said, we're here for questions and love to have the feedback and certainly here to answer any questions.
Any other questions, comments?
I have just sort of a question, a general question. What percentage of our ratepayers consume at or right near their tier one only?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question.
You mean tier, not their full budget?
Right, right. I mean,
oh, the tier, just tier one?
Right, I wonder
tier one's like the bottom, it's only 20% of consumption, so it's pretty, I would say probably, I'm just guessing, but very, very few, if any. I think most customers, I mean, the customers who really conserve water, everybody buys water in tier one. And where they're going to have conservation is in tier two if they're conserving right. below the budget.
But I think many of our seniors, that population, two people that have small households probably fall into that category, but we can get that number for you.
Yeah, maybe one or two people living at home. Mm-hmm. Minimal landscape. There are people.
Yeah, it's just...
in that category.
Yeah, it's a very small, I mean, that 20% of the 18 is very, I mean, 3.6, so.
I just remember Director Pauly, now president, previously noting that if we could highlight it, you know, it's in the customer's hands, substantially. You can get it down close, maybe you can't get it down too far, but you can take care of the wasteful watering, et cetera.
You know, average use, 15 to 18 CCF in that range. Tier 1 gives you about 3.6 CCF, so you can kind of get an idea. That's not a lot of water.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Other questions?
Director Armstrong?
I have some questions.
Yes.
Yes, I have a few questions and some comments. And really nice presentation, and it answered a number of my questions for me. So... I just want to make one comment on the pension item. I think it's great that you're going to switch from diverting those monies that are going to OPEB once that is funded and apply those to the pension. I really like the six-year approach, saving almost $100 million over that period of time. I think it's a great solution. The only comment I have on that is I do have a concern about being 100% funded with CalPERS because of the PEPRA law, you know, the law changes, you know, 6 or 8 years ago. Once you're 100% funded, if you get to that point, you can become overfunded and not have access to those funds that you have there and continue to have to make contributions at the full rate. And so I would just suggest you look at some other vehicle. Maybe you want to be 90% funded with CalPERS and set up the other 10% in a separate trust vehicle, like a 115 trust or something that gets you 100% funded, but it protects us from having, you know, funds with CalPERS that we can't use. So over the 6 years, if we move forward with this, I just suggest you take a look at that during that period of time and see if there's some value and merit to that. So that's just a comment.
Yeah. I was just going to say, Jeff, that's a great suggestion, and something that really does make sense.
That's what we had over at Rancho.
Yeah.
They have it separated out.
Yeah, because you can do it to 90% and then put the rest in so that that trust, the benefit of the trust is you can, if you have funds there, you can actually pay for your current costs. So it that makes a lot of sense, Jeff. Thank you.
Yep. So then I want to, on the recycled water rates that are going between 3% and 7%, is that based on a study that you said was done before, or is that being driven by the loss of the LRP revenues?
It's based on the 2017 cost of services study that had recommendations. What's interesting is it you know, again, cost of services study identifies the cost of providing that service. What my understanding is, you know, cost of service suggested what you could charge, and there was an implementation to try to bring up certain recycling water rates up to the cost of providing the service. And so I believe it was capped at 7% every year until it got up to that point. We are scheduled to do a cost of service study next year and retake a look at that. And I did not, you know, I did not provide the listing of each of the classes and the percentages, but it's very similar to the increases that were done this past January.
Okay. And then if I can jump over to the capital side, the CIP, the R&R, I think I got more clarity through the presentation, but I was a little confused. The R&R was referred to as rehab and refurbishment in one part, and then it was rehab and replacement. But then in the CIP, I saw that some of the CIP is replacement. And so I'm not sure I fully know where all these things are falling, but I think it's a tremendous tool to have your R&R planning tool that forecasts 100 years out what you need. I think that's tremendous. Absent the R&R model, do we have a five-year CIP program developed? Does our CIP for things other than R&R go out farther than 5 years? Are we looking at what our facility needs are out to build out? Do we project further out?
Yes. I'll give you the finance perspective, and then maybe engineering can talk about. We have master plans for each of the major systems, right? So water recycling and wastewater. And these plans go out to build out, Jeff. So interesting enough, it's projecting capital improvements from now, I think, until 2099, until what we conceive as build out. And so the current CIP model goes out for the next 80 years. And so really, you know, that includes not just the expansion, but also the R&R, that overall CIP model.
Can Joe add?
Okay, that's wonderful.
Jeff?
Did my question – oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, yeah. Dr. Armstrong, this is Joe. So I did want to just add to what John described. We have a very granular CIP, specifically over the next 10 years. We have identified projects that are – identified, tracked, scheduled, and as John mentioned, our master plans do identify our overall projects until build out. Having said that, we go through an annual cycle to look at our CIP on an annual basis and to get more details that we provide to finance on a five-year basis. So we prioritize, we adjust schedules, we adjust budgets, and it is an annual cycle that we perform to make sure we have the correct budgeting information for finance. So I don't know if that helped clarify.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful, and that helped a lot. And then that brings me really to my question on this is where I'm sort of struggling a little bit is how we fund these master plans in our R&R going forward. Do we have a long-term comprehensive financial model that's looking out over those periods of time and identifying what we need to do and how we're going to get there? It looks to me like when you look at this, we're relying on this net margin and even some of these windfalls that we're seeing that we say we need, But is there a comprehensive financial model that's really showing us what we need to do when, so that we're not caught short, that we are funding for what we need to do? So that's really the question. Do we have that kind of a model?
So I'm going to say not yet, but we are, and I'm looking at Laura. We are working on it, Jeff. There was a initial model done two or three years ago that wasn't necessarily fully utilized. And so right now, finance staff is working with our consultant, Raftellis, to update that model. And that will do exactly what you're saying, Jeff, because in that model, we do break out capital, which is expansion, and R&R, and then all the other major costs. And it's pretty granular as well, very similar to the CIP and the R&R model. I would anticipate, with budget and everything, our real goal is to try to get something up into the board this summer or early fall. But that would ultimately take the current budget that is approved and make that our baseline, and then from there we will build out the model. And that goes out, I believe, 20 years, Jeff.
Okay. No, I appreciate that. And I think for me personally, I think need to see that and see what it really shows before I think it's your alternative approach. You know, I agree you need to be funding for it. You need to start doing that. But to me, it's sort of just it's not based off of a model or a report that's telling us what we need to do. So for me, of your rate scenarios, I'm reluctant to do that until you have that model in place that really tells us what we need to do. So those are my comments.
All right. Thank you.
Any other directors, questions, comments?
Yeah, Director Armstrong brought up the recycled water, 4-7%, and that's, I understand that, okay, costs have gone up, we have to recover that, but this is an area that it's supply and demand, and I think we're reaching a point where we're going to see less demand, the rates continue to increase at that level. We had a discussion in Planning Committee about when we do the cost of service study or however it is that we look at that rate, we need to determine the value of keeping that water in the service area.
Yeah.
What is the cost of discharge? And are we putting ourselves at risk by discharging that someone downstream will say, you can't stop discharging now? So it's a difficult, not difficult, but it's a very large discussion. And, obviously we want to keep every resource we have within our service area, because we know that someday we'll need that water for indirect potable reuse or whatever. So I think we need to have some ideas about how we allocate costs or however you want to put it. But
okay,
that'll be an interesting discussion.
All right.
I agree with Randy. I was the same Planning Committee, and that was a topic there. So.
Okay.
Says to me.
All right. Thank you very much. Look forward to the next round.
Yes, in 5 short weeks.
Thank you. Thomas, good morning.
Morning, President Pauly, members of the
board. Give us an excellent land of security financing policy overview presentation.
Yeah, it looks like I'm batting ninth. I will do my best to
Hit a couple homers, okay?
Keep this interesting, exciting, and concise.
In the American League, then you would have a DH, and you wouldn't be able to bat.
That's true.
Not swinging.
Who's your favorite team, Dr. Corona?
The Dodgers.
Okay, great. National League. Okay, so I will cut the malarkey as much as possible and keep it concise. This is an informational item that was brought on by Director Armstrong at the January 20th board meeting, wherein he asked an item be brought back to the board for discussion on the debt policy, specifically the land secured financing policy. Today's agenda, I'm just going to give an update, background on the program, give a brief history on the policies that have essentially created the comprehensive debt policy, I'm going to dive into the land secured policy principles, which is really the point of today's discussion. Then I'm also going to discuss some of the revisions that are being considered and then open it up for discussion. The intent today, obviously, is to give an update and a background on the policy and then to take feedback and direction we receive from the board to ensure that the revised comprehensive debt policy that we bring back to the board meets the district needs and continues to be a guiding principle for the district. Just a quick background, general obligation bonds were used predominantly to facilitate financing water and sewer facilities. Then in 1978, Proposition 13 passed, which restricted government's abilities to finance those improvements without a vote from the constituents. In response to Prop 13, the Mella-Ruse Community Facilities Act was passed in 1982, which provided an additional financing tool for California municipalities, wherein newly developed areas would pay for the improvements that benefited that specific area. CFD usage in the state. The state's currently updating their report, and the last information available is for June 30th, 2018. As of that date, the state had 282 agencies that have issued CFD bonds. Of the 982 bonded CFDs, roughly a third is in the county of Riverside. Eastern is among active leader in terms of CFD formations, and currently we have 62 CFDs encompassing a total of 102 financing areas. From 1980 to 2001, 13 assessment districts were formed, and seven of those remain active today. As you can see in the line graph below, from 2001 to 2006, when CFD activity and largely development activity in our service area was very busy. Then during the housing market crash and subsequent Great Recession, development pretty much stalled. CFD formations obviously stalled and stayed stagnant up until about 2013. The economy improved prior to that. Development activity picked back up. And then since then, we've been pretty consistent as far as CFD formations go, and we continue to see that in the near future. Staff provided a version of this slide to the board back in October regarding in a presentation for CFD economic impact to the district's service area. The information provided to the board then was $258 million invested in the community, supporting 16,500 homes. Since then, an additional $8 million has been financed, most of which go into Eastern's water and sewer facilities. Also, some cities and some parks have benefited from those. This map shows where the districts, where Eastern's land-secured districts are located. The green being assessment districts, and then the red being the community facilities districts. The map shows a visual representation of where much of that growth has occurred over the last 20 years. We see a pretty big concentration in French Valley, and then also the city of Menifee has also grown quite considerably in that same time period. And then we also see a pretty big cluster in the Red Hawk area of Temecula. I grew up in this area, and I've drank Eastern water throughout my life. Early college days, I probably should have drank a little bit more Eastern water, but we'll save that for another day.
Don't beat yourself up.
Okay. This map, information was requested by Director Armstrong. And this map is a result of that. Director Armstrong had requested to see CFDs compared to the rest of the development in our service area. Then he also asked about Eastern's involvement with JCFAs with other agencies. The map shows the residential development activity since 2001. Eastern formed CFDs are in red, and all others are in gray, including those where Eastern is a party to a JCFA with another agency. There are a total of 143 JCFAs that Eastern has entered into. I wasn't able to obtain and analyze the data on a parcel number basis for in time for today's meeting, but the map does show where the CFDs are in relation to the rest of the development activity, and then I provided a summary, two summary tables on the right to show context of Eastern's involvement with JCFAs. A couple notable highlights, five different cities we have several JCFAs with, and out of the 143 JCFAs, 109 of those being school districts, and there are eight different school districts in our area that we've entered into a JCFA with. Then also we've entered into two JCFAs with Rancho.
Can I ask
sure.
a question?
Yeah, sure.
So if you entered into a JCFA with another entity and that has already been paid off, then that wouldn't appear on the map, correct?
We did our best to exclude JCFAs that are no longer active.
I'm thinking of 8159 down in the Temecula area. That is virtually all paid off, but that's because I'm seeing blanks down there, which should be in 8159. So that's why I'm thinking.
Yeah, I believe that. I don't know the year that was formed. We tried to limit the activity to show new activity since 2001.
Okay, it was 1989 when it was formed.
Okay, so that makes sense. Yeah, we went through the data, tried to show the activity in relation to when our CFD program really started to show context. Okay. If we included all Eastern connections,
it'd be all
it would it just wouldn't be of any value. Does that answer your question,
yes.
Director? Okay. So all in all, since 2001. Over 81,000 residential connections have been made, and of those, approximately 61% have either been an Eastern-led CFD or a JCFA between Eastern and another agency. A couple notable highlights. The largest city is the city of Paris that we've had a JCFA with, being 3,680 parcels, and the largest school district is the San Jacinto School District, where over 6,100 homes have benefited from JCFAs with that school district. I've summarized the process for CFD formations to give context. I know we go to the board several times throughout the process, and I've highlighted the board's involvement. For the purposes of time, I'm not going to go through the entire process. I'd be happy to discuss if there are specific questions, but I just wanted to give the board context. A question came up back in January as far as a resolution of intention that we were setting a public hearing, and this slide, the purpose for this slide is to show the steps involved and then the board's involvement bordered in red. And we just had a public hearing at the beginning of this month for a CFD formation in French Valley. The next slide is similar. This one shows the process for the CFD bond issuance process. Essentially, the team receives a request from the developer. We analyze it, go over credit strategy, determine plan of finance. And then we prepare the legal and financing documents. We also will pursue credit rating if it makes sense. Our last credit rating we did was back in January for the pooled refunding, a very successful transaction. Then the board adopts a resolution, approves the documents. Then we work with the underwriter to market and sell the bonds, and then followed by the bond closing a couple weeks later. Here's a policy history. After Prop 13 passed, From 1982 to 1989, several resolutions were passed which ultimately created an assessment district financing program. In 2000, the policy was rewritten to include use of community facilities districts. And prior to that revision, CFDs were essentially excluded from consideration. As I explained earlier, 2001 is when the district really began forming CFDs. After the crash and Great Recession in 2010, the policy was amended to include additional risk mitigation measures. Then, in 2013, the policy was revised with inclusion of key policy principles. And then, lastly, in 2017, the comprehensive debt policy was established, which was required by the state, and I'll go over more in a couple slides here, but it incorporated several key standalone policies related to the district's debt and incorporated into one comprehensive policy. As I mentioned, the land secured policy principles, they're based on protecting various stakeholders of the district. Some flexibility was added to the policy as development activity picked back up in 2013. But instead of just adding flexibility, we also want to make sure that it made sense and that the district was protected and that great decisions were made. Moving on to the comprehensive debt policy. This was required by the state where debt policy needed to be adopted, and this policy applies to all Eastern obligations, all of the general district debt, the Eastern Financing Authority, all the CFDs and ADs that the district administers, and the policy was also adopted by the Western Riverside Water and Wastewater Financing Authority, which is the JPA between Eastern and Rancho. Now, the root of the discussion, I wanted to highlight and summarize the policy principles, and then following these four slides, I will go over the revisions that are being considered. Please interrupt me at any time to ask any questions, or we can save them for the end. The special tax ratepayer protection policy was added to protect the landowners by limiting the special tax rates to a reasonable level. The overlapping special tax rate is to be at or below 2% at the time bonds are issued, and we require that developers provide a written disclosure of special tax to the home buyers prior to escrow closing. The investor protection policy principle was added to protect investors who invest in Eastern CFD bonds. Special taxes are levied in advance of the issuance of bonds, and bonds are required to be issued with a reserve fund. An additional special reserve may be established, and foreclosure provisions are also included in the policy. To date, we have not had to foreclose on a property. The customer protection policy principle was added to protect the district's customers. Property developers are required to pay in advance for formation costs. We don't want our ratepayers paying for the administrative time and expenses related to forming these CFDs. Growth pays for growth. So a developer wants to develop a project, form a CFD. In advance of the time and effort spent on that, we require a deposit to be made. In addition, other several key guidelines are included in the policy to ensure the district's standing in the credit market remains strong. Value-to-lien ratio of 4-to-1 or greater, delinquency level at or below 5%, and we also require a letter of credit if the property owner will be paying more than 20% of the special tax. There's also a preference for larger districts for efficiency, economies of scale, and broader delinquency protection. Moving on to policy revisions, and this is the last slide, and then we can open it up for discussion. It's prudent to review regularly policies to make sure that they're updated as needed, which ensures the policy remains an active document that doesn't become stale or obsolete or a dislocation occur between the district needs and what the policy says. As I summarized earlier, the debt policy has been revised several times over the last few decades, and the intent is to continually review the policy and make revisions as economic factors change, the district's goals or mission changes, and certainly the board's vision for the work that Eastern does. Just want to highlight these revisions, and happy to answer any questions. So the first one, we'd like to revise the minimum lot requirement to align with our actual practice by reducing the minimum threshold to 100 lots, and then between the 100 lot to 150 lot, require an additional non-pledged special reserve for those developments. That's what we're doing today, and the additional non-pledged special reserve helps protect those property owners. It helps add in some delinquency protection, and we only form CFDs or bring for recommendation to the board CFDs that make sense. Oftentimes, we turn CFD projects down, or we refer them to find another development to partner up with to create a healthier district. So I know we're here often, and we come to the board often for these, but you know the ones that we turn down, you don't see that. It's an active program that we really take serious. Secondly, we also want to make sure that the special tax rates don't escalate. Currently, it's a practice that we require them not to escalate, but it's not written in the policy. So this just formalizes that. Most agencies won't allow them to escalate, and we just want to make it official in the policy. Then we also want to strengthen the letter of credit requirements. Currently, developers are allowed to fund the letter of credit with cash. In the event a developer were to go bankrupt, that cash would be subject to being returned through bankruptcy hearings. Obviously, our legal counsel would not allow that to happen without a good fight, but we'd like to avoid that. A letter of credit from a bank doesn't follow the same principles or guidelines when it comes to bankruptcy, and it'll add some risk mitigation to the debt policy. And then also on the JCFAs, we don't have a formalized policy for this. We'd like to incorporate a section of the policy to memorialize what we're doing today and to align it with our current practices. Some of those topics include a 2% effective tax rate. We require that the lead agency doesn't put Eastern's name on the property tax bills. And then also, we require that Eastern's portion isn't larger or exceed the lead agency's portion. If it did, we might as well certainly form that CFD and manage that district. Then there's other miscellaneous terminology and procedural updates. They're not material, but just keep the document active and updated. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or take any comments.
Any questions? Director Armstrong?
Yes. I do have some questions and comments, and I want to first say thank you very much. Very helpful presentation. On this slide you have up on the policy revisions being considered, when do you think that will be brought back to the board for consideration?
Director Armstrong, it's currently scheduled for April, but certainly if there is feedback or guidance or things to look into resulting from today's discussion, then certainly we can push it back. We're not required to bring it back to April, but certainly we're ready to do so. As far as the general district updates, there's nothing significant. It's mainly just terminology and just very minor updates. The more involved updates are included in the land secured section of the policy.
Okay. So I want to echo your comments on this last slide where you started, where it's prudent to review these policies and to talk about them. And it's really in that spirit that I also want to review these, because I do think from time to time things do change. And as you showed on your slide, that timeline, you know, I think things are a little different now after the 2010 crash. And the map that I appreciate that map you put together, the map I was looking for was really after the 2010 crash forward. But that was still very helpful. I think it's really critically important to look at a policy like this, because it has quite a big impact on our customers, on our homeowners that are buying homes in these communities. And the problem that I have with the policy isn't that we're doing these, it's what's included in the financing, what's eligible to be financed, and more specifically, it's the capacity fees. I fully appreciate in-track facilities that are going to benefit the homeowners of a development directly, you know, including those in a CFD, and they pay for it over 30 years over the life of those facilities or and even more. But I appreciate that. But I have a harder time with the capacity fees being included. To me, the developer should be paying those capacity fees directly. That's still growth paying for growth. They're the customer at that point. They should pay those and not pass those on to the future homeowners. That then creates an issue for Eastern, in that those are then resources that our future homeowners and customers have to compete with, to pay us, to pay their property taxes, and pay these additional assessments. And so I would just like to ask for the policy revisions that are going to be considered, that we throw into the mix for conversation and consideration, is whether or not the capacity fee component is included in eligible financing or excluded from it. So I would ask that we add that to the policy revisions being considered. I think for me, that's the biggest issue that I have. And then, you know, looking at your map and seeing since 2001, you know, the majority of the developments out here are CFD or JCFA, you know, developed with those in there. And I would imagine it's a greater percentage after 2010. But to me, that burden that our customers have is a burden that when we compare rates to other agencies and we say, this is our rate, and we say, like, this is Rancho California Water District's rate, and we want to add the ad valorem on for Rancho California Water District customers, well, we should add a component for the CFDs to our bills for comparison, for more apples to apples, because those ABs are paying the same thing that these fees are paying for. So I think we're putting we're not being transparent. We're putting an additional burden on our customers at the benefit of developers. I think the homes would develop anyways, and the developer would figure out how to pay the fees. Maybe they pass it on in the home price. Maybe they don't. But that's not our problem. So that's my request, is that we can include that for discussion with the board when we bring this policy back for review and action.
Can I address a couple of these issues, Director President Pauly?
Absolutely. Yes.
Thank you for those comments, Director Armstrong. And we certainly will bring that back for discussion. But with respect to the connection fees, they're going to end up in one of two places. Either they're going to be added on to the price of the house, or in this case, and in some cases, we authorize that being included in the CFD. So the developer is not going to absorb those. They're basically going to put them in one place or the other. So either they'll increase the price of the house or they'll do that. So I think to some extent you can look at it and say, well, those are either being financed by the customers having to get a larger mortgage to pay for that additional cost for the house, or they're being financed through this financing program. With respect to the customer comparison issue, I guess I would disagree with that, primarily because these are developer-related expenses.
The CFDs are not part of Eastern's infrastructure. They're part of the developer's donated infrastructure. They're paying for that developer's donated infrastructure or the developer's obligations, as you pointed out, for the connection fees. So to do a rate comparison that uses property taxes to develop to pay for district-wide infrastructure, I think it's an apple and an orange. But we certainly can have that discussion and would be happy to do so.
If I can, I would add, I agree with everything you said. I would just add, in places like Moreno Valley, where it's a little more economically deprived, raising the cost of a house, I mean, probably these fees are $50,000-plus per house or $40,000-plus per house for school and all of our fees. But whatever the case it is, it's so much per year. And adding that to the cost of the home, it would put a lot of people out of the market, especially the tract, lower income tract builders.
Yeah, I agree. And, spreading out across 30 years over the taxes, it really disperses the, instead of the first buyer of the home absorbing that in the mortgage, the increased cost of the home, if they own it for 5 years, 10 years, and then sell it, basically the next owner is absorbing their portion or their use of those. Then also, to Paul's point, the financing that we're able to get on these CFD bonds, 3%, 4% interest, in speaking with developers, their financing mechanism, the way they're able to get, lent the money, it's nowhere near the interest rates that we're able to finance these at. So arguably, the cost could be greater if the developer was to finance that and then incorporate it into the sale of the home.
And that makes sense, I mean, just based on the differential interest rates. So,
Well, I mean, I think those are valid points, but I think those things all cut both directions. I can get a home loan for 2.5% less than what the district's borrowing money for. And if the fees are going to be added to the price of the home and I pay it in my mortgage, I only pay it for the period of time I own the home. And the next homeowner who comes in and buys it pays it for their period of time. I think all of these things cut both directions. So I think it's just worthwhile to have the discussion and see if it really is going forward the best practice for Eastern. One other aspect I would bring up too is when you look at the overlapping debt and you start pushing other debt in our service area, other obligations, that I think that could come back to harm Eastern when we go to issue a financing and we need to finance facilities because the overlapping debt numbers become greater. And so I think it could hurt us in a financing as well. So anyways, thank you.
I can see the concern, but I think one of the original reasons we implemented these policies was because of the housing market, because it was not, no one was buying, and developers were having, and we were at the same time increasing our connection fees, our financial participation fees, and other agencies and school districts and WRCOG and for TUMP, all increasing, and it became particularly onerous on the lower income communities. So, but I'd certainly be willing to discuss sort of the particulars. I'm open.
Yeah, I think housing affordability is a key issue. It's a top-line issue in the state of California. And if you think of the escalating housing market, the ability to provide additional financing and financing these versus putting them in the initial cost of the house is a significant benefit.
All right, any other questions or discussion items?
Thomas, next time you get to back cleanup, okay?
Okay.
Not ninth.
I'm a American League guy, so we'll call it the designated hitter. Stop while you're
ahead. Thank you very much. Great presentation. Appreciate it. Look forward to you coming back in April. With that, we will move on to agenda item 7, which is receive and file for various committee reports, et cetera. I will look for a motion and a second on that.
Second.
Moved by Director Slauson, second by Director Record. May I have a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Very good. That passes 5-0.
That will bring us to our calendar review. Nicole, please join us. Good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. Yes. There are no new events to report at this time. On page 2 of your report, we have the board's master calendar for the next 3 weeks. Would you like me to go through these events,
Mr. Pauly? Unless anyone really needs to, I think we can read them for ourselves in the interest of time.
Thank you. Moving to page 3, we've got some key upcoming dates. Registration has been opened for the AQUA Virtual Spring Conference, scheduled for May 12th and May 13th. The agenda has not yet been published, but I will provide that to you as soon as it becomes available. If anyone would like to sign up, this is a district sponsorship, and there are 4 seats available. The upcoming board meetings for the next 3 months are listed, noting the special meeting on March 19th. Upcoming board committee meetings and interagency meetings are listed on pages 3 and 4. Are there any questions or changes on the calendar? That concludes my report. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Nicole. With that, we'll move on to directors' meeting reports, and we will start with Director Armstrong.
Okay. I will just touch on a couple of them. I did attend the Mead Valley MAC and the Good Hope MAC with Alma, our public information officer, and I just wanted to give her compliments for doing a great job presenting what payment assistance programs the district has during COVID and even ongoing ones. Thought she did a really good job, and there was a lot of appreciation from those groups and having the water district there, and so I think that participation and the district's involvement is worthwhile. I also participated in the AQUA Finance Committee meeting. I think that was last week, and basically reviewed their financial results for 2020, and they ended up in a really pretty good position given COVID. The big impact on AQUA with COVID is the loss of the conferences, and those are very big revenue generators for AQUA, which helps reduce our dues to AQUA. Without having those, they did take a little bit of a hit, but they managed through it pretty well. I did receive a question from AQUA for an upcoming conference. They want to do a session on COVID payment assistance programs, and so I sent that over to the general manager. I hope it's something that Eastern can participate and share in at one of the conferences coming up. And those are really the highlights.
All right. Thank you very much. Director Corona?
Okay. On March 3rd, I had a quick meeting with President Pauly and General Manager regarding some comments that were made by Rancho Water District directors at their meeting. Then on March 11th, the Rancho meeting, they had their first budget discussion on their rates, fees, and charges. That's all I have.
All right. And, yes, we did have a meeting on the Murrieta Division. I'm sure there are going to be more to come on that. I certainly want Director Corona involved in everything going forward on that as that comes to fruition, hopefully, in the next couple months. I also just had the usual great meeting with the general manager to go over some of the items upcoming on future agendas and just things happening here at the district. Director Record.
The Joint Inland and Orange County Caucus review of MET agenda and standing committee and board meetings at Metropolitan. You have a written report in your packet. Monday morning group legislative meetings, March 4th through the 11th. Typically, we go to Sacramento. This year, all the meetings are virtual, and they've been kind of spread out. But the meetings that I have participated in and the 4 issues that we have are COVID relief, Bay Delta conveyance, agency consolidation, and climate change. Good meeting with President Pro Tem Adkins, Senator John Laird, Chair Joaquin Escobar from the State Board, and this morning Secretary Crowfoot from the Resources Agency. So those have been, I think, very productive and good meetings.
All right. Thank you very much. And then finally, Director Slauson.
Yes, I attended an update with the General Manager on the 11th, just an update on all the outstanding issues, everything we discussed today and more. I attended the SOPA Commission meeting yesterday, and it was agendized to discuss the OWOW and roundtable budgets, appropriating for round two grants, and the disadvantaged community involvement update. I also attended the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce on the 5th, and I don't have my notes, but I do recall there was an update from the Riverside University Health System on COVID, different conventions, and I actually asked some questions, but also updates from the school and the city of Moreno Valley.
Okay. Very good. With that, we'll move on to directors' comments or future agenda items. Do any directors have a comment or anything for a future agenda? Hearing none, we will ask our general counsel. I understand we have a need for a closed session item.
Thank you. Yes, this is Chelsea Sharp speaking. As identified in agenda item A, the board will be meeting in closed session pursuant to Government Code Section 54957 on a public employment matter.
Very good. With that, we will take a moment to close, to go over to our closed session telephonically. I'm sorry, 9 a.m. on April 7th. Thank you, Chelsea.